All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are recording and broadcasting. The floor is yours.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Welcome to the February 18th Regional Water Quality Control Board. We are meeting online during the COVID-19 pandemic in order to comply with public gathering limitation and physical distancing requirements as authorized by Government Code Section 11133 and Executive Order N-1-22. There is no physical meeting room, and this meeting is being conducted entirely remotely by online access. We are receiving presentations and public comment through the Zoom webinar platform. The Zoom meeting link has been made available to the public via our agenda website. For people who would like to watch and listen to the meeting, the Water Board webcast is also available. If you are a presenter, you should already be in the Zoom webinar as an attendee and using the meeting link provided by the board's website and should have submitted a virtual speaker card online via the request form. If you're having trouble with the remote meeting link or the webcast, please contact the clerk at this following email, rb3-comment letters. That's capital C-O-M-M-E-N-T, capital L-E-T-T-E-R-S, at waterboards.ca.gov. Presenters and speakers will be on mute with your camera turned off until it is your time to speak. The meeting host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done, the board member will ask you if you have any questions. And if not, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom webinar until the completion of your item, and you may choose to exit the webinar, continue via Zoom, or follow the webcast online. The meeting is being webcast and recorded, so please speak slowly and clearly. That also means me. So welcome again to the meeting. It's now 9:03. I'm going to turn to our roll call, please.
Chair Gray.
Present.
Vice Chair Wolf.
Present.
Member Hunter.
Present.
Member Harlan.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. The next item on the agenda is introduction, staff recognitions, and awards, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Keeling for this portion of the agenda. Good morning.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Good morning to you as well and all others joining us today. I'll just start with introducing our management team, legal counsel, clerk to the board. So I'll start with Tammy Olson, our clerk to the board.
Morning.
Good morning. Thanks for getting us started off with roll call. Next, I'll introduce our legal counsel, starting with Ms. Stephanie Yu.
Good morning.
Good morning. Next, Chris Moskal.
Good morning.
Chris, I'll start with our assistant executive officer this morning, Taya Tryon.
Good morning.
Morning. And now for our section managers, Mary Hamilton.
Good morning.
Hello, Mary. Next, I'll introduce Angela Schroeder.
Good morning.
Hello. And last but not least, Harvey Packard is also helping us with some of our back-end Zoom meeting coordination today.
Morning.
Morning, Harvey, thank you. And also I'd like to introduce our State Water Board liaison, board member Sean McGuire.
Hello, all.
Morning, board member McGuire. Thanks for joining us today. We're looking forward to getting your report, as always. And I've got a couple staff announcements for you this morning. And for that, I will turn it over to Phil Hammer, who's our program manager for our stormwater program.
Hi, thanks, Matt. Good morning. I have two announcements. The first is that Allie Koblenz, who has been an environmental scientist in our stormwater program for about 3 years, is switching over and has been hired in our position as an engineering geologist in our wildfire resiliency program. And so Allie is going to be helping us get that program up, you know, running and solidified. It's fairly new. She'll be working on, you know, minimizing water quality impacts for wildfire prevention activities, as well as the back end after fires occur with wildfire recovery work as well. So join me in congratulating Allie.
Welcome, Allie. I'm sure you're going to be very busy, unfortunately. Had a lot of burns in our area.
Yeah, I agree. The second announcement I have is I'd just like to introduce you to Brianna Muirhead. Brianna, if you can turn on your camera. Brianna is a student at Cal Poly. She's our stormwater intern. She's been with us for about 6 months now, but her busy student schedule has not aligned with the board meeting schedule until today. So she's been helping us a lot with doing a lot of administrative work with the thousand of stormwater enrollees that we have in our stormwater program. There she is. So join me in welcoming Brianna with a belated welcome.
Welcome, Brianna.
Thank you.
That's all I have. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for the introduction, Phil.
All right, welcome. All right, thanks, Phil. And also just before we go to the next item, I just want to let Board Member McGuire know that we'll get to your update after our public forum, which I believe is the next item. So I'll turn it back to Chair Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Keeling. That's correct. Public forum is the next item on the agenda. This item is for items not on the agenda, public speaking for items not on the agenda. Ms. Olson, do we have items for public forum this morning?
We do, but they're not here.
Okay. Did we receive any communication?
Well, we received one request, but they're not here.
Correct. I understand. They didn't let us know they would be running late.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I would advise that we, if you're ready, Mr. McGuire, we take your comment first, and then we can move to public forum after that.
We can do that. No problem.
Great, thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. And good morning. And first, let me just start off. My name is Sean McGuire, State Board member, and your liaison, which is, you know, really an informal role. And just for those who haven't seen me here before, you know, we have five State Board members, and each of us are assigned to generally two or three different of the nine regional boards. And you know, our goal is to just better interconnect between the state and regional levels. And so I'm here, I come and provide an update, but really this is, you know, a fluid, hopefully, conversation that we can have. And really I'm here to address any questions that you have as regional board members. And, you know, first let me just start off by saying congratulations, Chair Gray, for your election as the chair of the board yesterday. I think that's great news. And also Vice Chair Wolf, thank you for your service as chair over many years. And also thank you for keeping the the responsibility level up there as the vice chair. It's good to see. So, you know, every one of these updates, it's been a couple of months since I've been here. And so I was thinking about what would be best to share with you today. And it's often hard to whittle down the list because it's so extensive in terms of the different priorities that we're all faced right now in the water space. If you look at our water quality challenges, I could talk for days about our drought and those issues, or equity issues that we're facing in our water throughout the state. And so I thought maybe just to help out a little bit with this, what would be best is just to point out that we do try to organize all of our priorities and put them in a, you know, somewhat digestible format. And that's at the State Board, we do that through our strategic priorities work plan, which we update annually. And so I actually just was notified yesterday that it was finalized. So we finally have our 2022 strategic work plan, and it's posted on the State Water Board website. It's a little tricky to find, but if you go to the Water Board's webpage and scroll all the way down to the bottom, in the bottom right-hand corner, there will be a little link there for board priorities, and that's where you'll find it. What you'll see there is our 15 pages of priorities. with little descriptions, and it goes into, you know, most of our, you know, key programs, but it doesn't even cover everything that we're doing at the state water board. But I just thought I would point out one page to you. And because we were so overwhelmed with the amount of priorities that we have, and we get together once a year as a board, you may do the same and talk about sort of your, you know, strategic priorities for the year. And so we struggle with that a bit because we have, you know, 5 board members, and you have board members, and you all have different priorities and interests and areas that you want to advance. And it becomes a challenge to mix that with, you know, our obligations and things that we just have to get done. So we end up with sort of a super priority list, if you will. We put little asterisks next to items that are extra important to us, and that we generally will prioritize staffing resources and other resources just to make sure that, you know, to the extent we can get those items over the finish line. Because that, you know, as you know, every year comes with new challenges and unforeseen events and things. You were just mentioning wildfires and the drought and such. I mean, things happen, and we have to be, the pandemic, you know, we have to be ready for different emergencies that pop up, and we're always nimble in that way. So if you were to pull up that page, which we won't do now, I just will highlight a couple of these things. You know, we have, the first is our COVID-19 response and our arrearages program. And I think we've talked about this before, but we had our drinking water arrearages program has been incredibly successful. You know, the legislature allocated up to $1 billion to help address, and essentially arrearages are just late bills that customers, either for their drinking water service or their wastewater service, weren't able to pay during the COVID-19 pandemic period. And so the $1 billion of funding is to help pay off those bills on behalf of those customers. And so it's a really unique opportunity, that honestly the first time we've ever had a program like this. And it was, the funding was allocated in last year's budget. And then we had the program up and running, frankly, and money going out the door within, I think, about 3 months, which is a breakneck, record-breaking pace, especially for a novel, brand new funding program like this. So it's really been an amazing effort. And I'm really happy to report, I think roughly $300 million has been allocated so far over the last 3 or 4 months to drinking water customers to pay off their bills that accrued during the pandemic. So really a testament to our staff and you know, our ability to get that out and rolling quickly. And what we're doing now is the wastewater arrearages component. So that was kind of a follow-on. And we just adopted the guidelines for that last month in January. And the application for that is now ongoing. They just got that out a couple of weeks ago. And so wastewater systems, in some cases counties, different POTWs, are able to apply for that arrearages funding as well. So we'll see how much comes in from that. But again, just a really exciting opportunity. And I'll give you an update as we go forward here and get a better sense for the wastewater side and how much need there is and how much funding gets requested. So, I mean, we just on the drinking water side, for, you know, there's 3,000 or so community water systems, and we had about 600, I think, that came in requesting funding. So we didn't get everybody, you know, unfortunately, but still a really good showing, I think, overall. You know, some of our other priorities on here, and I'm not going to describe all these in that same detail, but we have our hexavalent chromium drinking water standard. That's been a long time coming over the past few years. Just wanted to get that on your radar screen. That will be coming out here within the next month or so. And don't hold me to that, but somewhere around there, you will see a draft, probably more like an administrative draft of the recommended maximum contaminant level for hexavalent chromium. So we've been very anxious to get this out, to have this adopted, to have that protected drinking water standard in place. And so looking forward to moving that forward. It won't be easy. It's, you know, it's a difficult one, but I think it's really important that we have that, which is why it's been a priority for us as a board for the last couple of years now. You'll see a lot of other items on here on the list, like that relate to water rights issues, like curtailments, our water rights drought response, public trust flows, you know, in-stream flows, responding to drinking water systems through the drought, and, you know, modernizing our data systems. So water conservation, so there, you know, SGMA, groundwater management. So there's a thread throughout a lot of this, which is dealing with scarcity, water allocation, how do we balance those critical resources? And that is, in fact, where we are putting a lot of our focus through water rights and just, you know, not only thinking long-term, but also thinking in the immediate emergency that we're in here. And I think, you know, we've discussed the drought prior, you know, in prior board meetings. And clearly this has been, I think, climate whiplash is the phrase that's used a lot right now. And that's really what we've been seeing, you know, from that atmospheric river level 5 that we had way back in October, which seems like eons ago, a really great December in much of Northern California and lots of snow, you know, record-setting snow levels and precipitation in some cases. And now here we are in our second month of basically nothing, complete dryness, no precipitation. I think the Sierra's got 1 or 2 inches in this last week, which really doesn't amount to a whole lot. And so we're back again in crisis mode and feeling this uncertainty. And one thing is for sure, this is every year at this point, I mean, almost. You know, it's one extreme or another. And more often than not, it's been this dry cycle that we've been dealing with. And so we're trying to think through that. You know, how do we do this? How do we manage our resources in a more predictable, proactive way, less reactive? And we've done a lot of work in the last year, like having our curtailment regulations in place for the Bay Delta and some other watersheds that we didn't have before. And so those are rolling over. And we may be making some tweaks to them to refine the process, but generally, you know, we're starting this year off in a much better place from a water management perspective than we were a year ago, but we are not starting off in a much better place from a water supply perspective. And it is troubling. I think you can look at some of the reservoirs and see how low they are right now and recognize that it's gonna be another challenging year, barring a miracle March or, you know, some storms moving in here in the next month or so. So, you know, that's the reality of it. That's where we're focused a lot of our efforts on the water rights side. And, you know, lastly, on kind of the water quality priorities, we're doing a lot with stormwater right now. So we have a construction stormwater general permit, which expired, I think, something like 13 years ago. And that's been in development for quite some time now. There was a draft issued last year. We're moving forward towards a revised draft and hopefully adoption later this spring or early summer. So you'd stay tuned for that if that's an area that you're interested and engaged in. We are also working on, you know, lots of other aspects of stormwater, but I wanted to mention our, on the sanitary sewer side, we have a sanitary sewer management plan general order that has also been in development for quite some time, and that draft updated order is out for public comment, which I believe is due in the April timeframe. There's some workshops coming up on that as well. So, you know, just to highlight for you that we've got, you know, a lot of irons in the fire, a lot of things going on in different aspects of our programs. So as always, happy to answer any questions there. And then I'd be remiss not to mention all of the, you know, not just the arrearages program, but all of the funding that we have, whether it's the $1.3 billion for wastewater and drinking water infrastructure from the state budget, or now with the federal infusion, you know, to our state revolving fund program, we have something on the order of $6 billion coming in over the next 5 years. for similar types of investments. We have our SAFER program, which is $130 million a year. So it's clearly a priority to figure out how do we best spend those, you know, that really that windfall of money that in some respects we weren't really expecting a year ago, but here we are in this really fortunate position to be able to make kind of generational investments and upgrades that are sorely needed. You know, supporting consolidations, thinking about resiliency, treating for these emerging contaminants like PFAS and, you know, hex chrome new standards that come down. So there's a lot of needs out there, a lot of challenges, but it's really fortunate that we do have some funding resources this time. So over the next few months, we'll be sorting through that as well and really honing in on where those funds should be best allocated. So I know that's a lot. I think I'll leave it there. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Thank you for that introduction. I certainly have questions, but I'd like to open it up to my colleagues. Vice Chair Wolf. Vice Chair, you are on mute.
Is this better?
Much better.
Yes.
All right. So the first one, relates to recycled water. As you indicated, Mr. McGuire, there are a lot of fundings right now for infrastructure upgrades, wastewater consolidation, sewering, et cetera. But within our region, and I would venture throughout the state, you know, you have quite a few plants which do have the recycled water capabilities or infrastructure in place, but lack the distribution infrastructure. In fact, yesterday on a small scale was, you know, is a facility that has recycled water, but they don't have the purple pipe system. So I was wondering in these, what I'll call avalanche of monies coming in, both from the federal government and because of a record California budget for the last 2 years. Can you tell me a little bit where some of these distribution purple pipe infrastructure project would fit in some of the various upcoming financial assistance?
Yeah, sure, yeah, great question. I think, you know, recycled water, you know, I didn't even bring that up, but that is something that we're working on quite a bit as well. I think you know that we're working on our direct potable reuse regulations, and those are aiming to be completed by next year. And that all fits within the toolbox of resiliency and how do we have all kinds of supplies. And so there's not a one perfect solution. So yes, purple pipe in some cases is the right choice for different areas. You know, it just depends. And we do have 200, don't hold me to this exactly, but $200 million for recycled water investments statewide currently available. And that was from the state budget. And then the SRF, you know, funding through the Infrastructure Act. I think the allocation for wastewater was about $2 billion. And as far as I'm aware, you know, those types of projects are eligible, but you know, if you really want specifics and have specific projects, I'd have to connect you with our Division of Financial Assistance to confirm that and make sure that those are eligible projects. But I believe that they are.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Second question, which is a question that I had a year ago, a little over the beginning of a year, and this was with your predecessor liaison, Ms. D'Adamo. And that was the topic of the, you know, challenges in California with the unsheltered people. And, you know, the realization that the issue of the unsheltered is not a state water board, regional water board, you know, specific, because it involves other agencies. But, you know, as I have discussed several times with your chair, is that we're part of a sister agencies that have to have dialogue And so it was suggested last year, and it was at one of the monthly chairs meeting, which I participated, that your chair was gonna, you know, take this a little bit up the ladder through CalEPA and say, okay, how can we all work together since our governor has, you know, unassigned, and I forgot the title, but, you know,
kind of a task force. Yeah.
Task force, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Task force on that. And that the State Water Board really should have a seat because of, you know, obviously water quality goes hand in hand and the human right to safe drinking water goes hand in hand with the topic. So do you know where that stands?
No, that's a very good question. I had the same thought, actually. I know it wasn't in the discussion with you, and I'm not at the chair's calls, but I do have a discussion coming up with the chair later today. So thank you for flagging that. I will ask him about the status there and what the state board, how we're engaging with our state administrative colleagues there.
Yeah.
And I'll report back to you.
Thank you very much. Last question, and you mentioned one of them. Statewide orders, and you know, we do have, as you well know, regions have specific orders. For a good example in the past was the winery order. Mm-hmm. Each region had their own, and we have now a statewide order. So could you, if you have that information in your head, you know, what are currently statewide orders being developed or being planned to be developed that would take over, or that would basically morph, better choice of word, morph existing regional orders into a statewide order in order to achieve better consistency?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, a couple of the ones that I mentioned are, you know, we have our construction general permit. So a lot of, we're updating a lot of existing statewide orders versus thinking about whether there's any new ones that are being considered. And I'm not thinking of any off the top of my head, but what I will say is there's still a movement towards statewide policies. So thinking about nutrient management, you know, biostimulatory, you know, a couple of years ago, we adopted the statewide toxicity provisions. You know, we have trash provisions. So not necessarily, you know, statewide permitting orders, but yes, policies for water quality control. One we're working on right now, there was actually just a scoping meeting last night, or, you know, late afternoon, was for developing site-specific objectives for copper and zinc. So it, mostly a stormwater issue, but really thinking about metals toxicity and how we don't have a consistent approach statewide using kind of the latest, the biotic ligand model for evaluating toxicity issues. And so in some cases you end up with watersheds that have really, really, really low limits on metals. But if you look at it with this kind of newer tool, it's actually less of a biological concern in those watersheds. So we're trying to provide some guidance that applies statewide there. It'll be some time before we have something like that. So that's all that pops into my head currently. But again, I'll flag taking a look there. We have a list on our executive director's report that has a list of all the different permits and programs that we're working on in water quality. So it would have anything in there that we're thinking of right now.
All right. Well, thank you very much for answering my questions and helping me understand a little bit where things are in Sacramento. Thank
sure.
you.
Happy to help.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. Dr. Hunter? Thank you, Dr. Wolf. Dr. Hunter?
Couldn't get unmuted. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gray. And It's always a pleasure to hear from you, Mr. McGuire. And I am, I think we're all heartened at the many, many opportunities we see with the funding stream coming at us with, just seems like everything we're hearing has to happen right now.
Yeah, we know
it has to happen right now because of the nature of the problem. But on the other hand, you know, the solution is complicated and the monies are difficult to prioritize. And so we're watching and hoping for, a good share of those monies coming our way. I have something to bring to your attention. It's not really in the form of a question, and it's kind of getting into the weeds on AB 1215, which we had a hearing item on that yesterday, which is consolidation, wastewater, potential consolidation of with wastewater systems for disadvantaged communities and severely disadvantaged communities. And it's a situation that we feel will be potential for our region, given the rural character of the region. What concerned me as I was reviewing this, the description, I looked at the language of AB 1215, is the way in which I think it's very exciting to see the amount of money going into it, capital investment, and recognizing upgrades or expansion costs to accommodate these new hookups, and even legal fees are considered reimbursable in the language of the bill. But in the long run, I did not see how the cost of the individual households, once all of this, once the hookups are accomplished, in terms of affordability, I did not see any recognition that we are hooking up to disadvantaged community, individual households, or severely disadvantaged individual households, and creating an additional fee for them that will continue for the life of their residency, whether they're renters or owners. So I'm hoping that we're in a very early stage with these programs, and that we can keep in mind and consider at an earlier stage than perhaps waiting until implementation has been accomplished and then rates are assessed and so forth. And how will we assess affordability to these individual households? I think Mr. Keeling yesterday had some very positive and constructive comments about how staff in our region might approach it. And I'm hoping you'll carry that, concern that perhaps in the long run, these households will carry a burden that is essential and necessary, but there may be ways to offset it or perhaps bridge it or ramp it so that over time, these households are not faced with an additional $50 or $60 a month outlay. I'm guessing at that amount. I have no idea. I know what my sewer bill is. So it's just a thought I wanted to share with you. And if you have comments on that, that would be welcome. But otherwise, just something I wanted to bring to your attention.
Yeah, thank you for that. I agree. I think there's, as you probably know, there's no customer assistance, affordability program for either drinking water or wastewater in California at this point. There are programs like LIHEAP, which is a federal program to help with energy bills, rates, and certain utilities do have customer assistance programs, but there is no statewide resource there. And there has been discussion in the legislature for how to set that up. And I think again with the arrearages program that I talked about, and we've learned a lot about those issues and how maybe a pilot program could support that. But I appreciate you flagging that it's not just the drinking water side, which has been sort of the focus of a lot of attention, but wastewater bills can be quite hefty as well. And so that's something we should all be just cognizant of and thinking about the long-term costs and the impacts on customers. Yeah, appreciate that.
Thank you. Yeah. And, I think we're learning a lot in terms of environmental justice and in terms of looking at the costs of cleaning up situations that are decades and decades in the making. And those unfortunate areas that are challenged both financially and environmentally, the details of those situations are becoming clearer. And I think as we move forward, hopefully we can fold in some of what we're learning and recognize that we will continue to face these challenges, especially where disadvantaged communities and severely disadvantaged communities are concerned. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter. Ms. Harlan, did you have any question or comment?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Then we've reached the end here. I'll jump in, Mr. McGuire. And thank you for joining us this morning. Thank you for your congratulatory words and really appreciate you sitting here virtually with us in the hot seat while we just sort of lob questions at you. So I appreciate you being able to answer those. So I just have a few things and I'll follow up a little bit on what Dr. Hunter brought up related to 1215, a couple of the considerations that we had. And certainly Mr. Garcia did a really great job providing us with a presentation. I think some of the items that we and I was particularly concerned with was, one, outreach strategy to ensure that folks that really need these services and the vast amounts of funding are aware that they have funding, because as Dr. Hunter indicated, everything is due now. Mm-hmm. And so I'm on the LIRIS list. I get, 100 emails a day, not that many from State Board, but I do get quite a bit. And they're all in English and they all come out. But I'm wondering, and I'm sure you have a Spanish listserv, but I'm wondering for folks that are not on those listservs in those really hard to reach communities, when funding is flowing right now and applications need to advance right now, what's the State Board's outreach strategy to get at those communities?
Yeah, that's a great question. And certainly I probably would defer to our Office of Public Participation on that, Adriana Renteria and Nefertari Cooley, who's our Strategic Communications Director. I mean, those are issues that they think about all the time. And I know they've been making really concerted efforts to reach out to communities directly and through different means to enhance that type of connectivity to make sure we are getting the word out. It's hard. It's challenging.
Yeah.
We've made a lot of improvements there, I would say, in terms of being more accessible, providing materials in multiple languages, like you just said, and hopefully a lot of this will include just being out there in person as well. I mean, trying to do everything virtually and reaching people has its own challenges. And benefits in some cases, but
right.
Sometimes there's just community folks that won't, may just not get the message regardless. I don't even know what the LIRIS list is.
Right.
Let alone know that there's a really unique opportunity for funding and such. So, So one thing I can offer perhaps is to have one of them come back to one of your board meetings and provide an update and discussion of that, of outreach to the communities, either for this program or just broadly, and what we're thinking about, if that would be helpful.
Yeah, I think it would be really helpful because we live in a really gigantic state and it's going to be, tailored, obviously, just as we have regional boards, tailored to different areas of the state where there's different challenges, different, hurdles to overcome. To the extent that you can offer that, I think that'd be helpful.
Definitely.
And that sort of leads to the second item as it relates to the priority levels, because there's, DAC, SDAC communities, underrepresented communities, and then once that's exhausted, sort of smaller non-DAC communities, which really emphasizes the need to get that word out there so that highest priority needs are met. And then, once applications start coming in, that's a lot to review. And it's certainly a lot to understand. This gets to a couple different issues, Dr. Hunter's point, one of them. When you're looking at applications, are projects right-sized for the community? Once they're up and running, can they be maintained? Can they be operated? You know, that's another challenge, right? Where we have, at least in our region, I'm just going to take our region, lots of really small, isolated communities that are not really good candidates for consolidation. And oftentimes, even basic systems are hard to maintain. So just in terms of using that one-time slog of money, you know, being able to leverage it so that a community does have the opportunity to improve the situation, but also, you know, consideration of how that system would be operated in the long term and what that affordability component would be for that community. So I know that's a long question with lots of different angles in it, but I just don't know how you all are viewing that because it's complicated.
It
and
is.
I'm sure nobody has one answer, so.
No, but I mean, everything you're bringing up are issues that have been front and center for us for a number of years on the drinking water side, you know, and that's why we have requirements and things like TMF, you know, technical, managerial, right. Financial sort of requirements and aspects that we look at for any water system to ensure that if we're going to fund a project there, a drinking water project, that it will be operated and maintained right. In the long run, right? And
right.
That system can afford it and has the resources and operators in place that are, meet the requirements to do that. And so it's hard because sometimes those communities don't actually have meet those requirements, and yet they have important drinking water challenges that we want to fund. And so, you know, one of our emphasis through our SAFER program has been providing technical assistance and having community groups like self-help enterprises go out and actually work with those communities to get their house in order, to figure out what the right investment and types of plans and projects that actually make sense for that community are, and then bring those projects back to the board for funding. And I think that's really been helping with a lot of systems, you know, sort through those challenges where they don't have other resources to bring in, you know, high-priced consultants to help figure some of that out. And we're able to fund a lot of that. So I think the same applies on the wastewater side. And it gets really challenging with septic systems and, you know, that are disparate and don't really, you know, not really anyone overseeing it except maybe a county. And, you know, how do you, you know, tackle those problems? I think in many cases, they're going to just take a while to sort out and, you know, case-by-case situations. And I am concerned that the funding timing isn't going to mesh well with that, for sure. So, but I think it's a great point. How do we get technical support to those folks and really start honing in on the project solutions that are going to be sustainable?
Great. I appreciate that. And I'm glad that I knew you were all were thinking about it, and it sounds like you have some things in place, but it's just good to hear you articulate it. So thank you. And then turning to, you know, a point that Dr. Wolf mentioned related to reclaimed water, how are the IPR, DPR projects, if any, moving forward? You know, reclaimed water is great, but it is a redundant system to operate and maintain. So, you know, IPR gets you there quicker, but I don't know if there are really any projects on hand at this point. I know that, you know, that process, the expert panel wrapped up, and maybe you could just provide sure. us some insight there.
Sure. So, IPR, indirect potable reuse, which is taking highly treated, advanced treated wastewater, basically putting it, injecting it into the aquifer, groundwater, and then taking it out later. That's already permitted.
Right. So that, yeah, that's permitted. But it's
so that happens. So that we have direct. Monterey, Clearwater, right. and you know, yeah. lots of projects up and down the coast. And I think that will continue to be kind of a preferential approach because, you know, not only does it provide added layers of human health protection, but it gives you a place to put the water in storage until the time when you need it. So there's a lot of advantages there. But I think direct potable reuse will become a viable option as well here going forward. So, you know, our expert panel's been, as you mentioned, you know, has been working through our criteria or recommended treatment criteria. There's still some work to do there, but we are on track to have the regulations completed by the end of 2023. And I know there's a number of systems like City of LA at their Hyperion Wastewater Treatment Plant, LA County Sanitation Districts are partnering with Met to both, they're both looking at direct potable reuse and some combination with indirect potable reuse, but providing both those avenues because it is, even though they're not building maybe purple pipe necessarily, it's a lot of piping and infrastructure to move water around.
Right.
Basically the opposite. So the water right now comes in from the Colorado River or from the State Water Project, right? It comes in from the north or from the east and goes downhill towards the coast. And now they're talking about replumbing the system and having water go from the coast back uphill. And so it's going to be a huge, you know, a lot of the costs of those projects will be that, just the ability to be able to move water around to where it's needed. And I think there are a number of other communities that are looking at, you know, San Diego, you know, thinking of others up and down the coast, you know, thinking about direct potable reuse, but it'll become more of a real tangible thing, I think, once our criteria and our regulations are, you know, getting closer to the finish line.
Yeah, and it's still not maybe cost effective for smaller communities along the Central Coast. I mean, ultimately, the treatment train and the cost associated with treatment to that level is really quite high, too. So you do need an economy of scale for that. So, okay. And then lastly, microplastics. I know that the state board was working on, you know, microplastic issues, and I think that wrapped up in December. So just wanted an update on that as well.
Yeah, so the board adopted the microplastics definition about a year and a half ago, as you might recall. And the next step was really figuring out the analytical methods. So now that we know what a microplastic is and we can define it, what are our capabilities to actually measure it? And what we learned in a board workshop, I think that was in November, was that it's challenging. And actually, in some cases, our technology and our laboratory analytical capabilities just really aren't there yet to measure microplastics down to the nanometer scale, the really, really, really small ones. But we can measure some of the larger sized particles. And so it's still important to, you know, move forward with a testing program over the next few years to evaluate what the presence of those particles are in drinking water. And so that's the plan, I think, is kind of a phased approach to look at some of the bigger water suppliers and look at their, you know, kind of the concentration of microplastics in the water source, in the river, basically, or lake, and start collecting information. And hopefully over time, the laboratory's analytical capabilities will improve, you know, as we continue down this path. So that's kind of where we're at right now, is sort of a testing program. It's what was required through the legislation. So that's what we're going to do, but it's a little bit of a different approach than maybe was originally envisioned.
Great. Thank you.
I can update you as we get kind of move farther along with that.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I don't have anything else, but really appreciate you being able to come to us this morning and chat, Mr. Keeling.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. And thank you, Board Member McGuire. It's certainly a daunting task to try to describe, states' water quality, water supply related priorities. And I just wanted to bring this up, and this is not in the form of a question, but just for our board's awareness of one of the priorities on the 2022 strategic plan. And this is kind of relevant to a point that Vice Chair Wolf mentioned yesterday with respect to the high number of retirements and, you know, the hiring treadmill that we're on. And one of the priorities that's on that strategic plan is a workforce strategy. And I just wanted to give credit to the State Water Board and their efforts we've got a new recruitment unit, and they're looking at better ways to message our positions and, you know, entice people to work for us and do the great work that we do. And then also trying to streamline our hiring processes. And then on the back end, looking at, you know, new onboarding and training methodology. So I just want to point that out. Is, you know, it's a real significant priority for all of us right now, as we've got, you know, a wave of retirees going out and bringing new staff on board, and the time it takes to do that and how important it is. And what we tell our staff when we're going through our hiring processes is really there is no more important thing that we can do in putting our best foot forward and making sure we're hiring and onboarding and training and mentoring the best staff that we can that are going to succeed us. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thank you for bringing that up. Good point. All right. Well, thank you all.
Thank you very much. Good to see you. Have a good day.
Take care.
Thank you. So the next item we're going to return to is public forum. Ms. Olson, do we have our speaker?
One moment, please.
Okay, thank you. In the meantime, maybe we can have the timer up on the screen, please.
Bob?
Yes, maybe somebody at AGP can put the timer up on the screen, please.
One moment, we're trying to get it hooked up.
Thank you, no worries. Thank you, Bob.
Okay, I believe we are ready.
Okay.
We do have speakers that are.
We do. I see a hand up. So okay. We need to admit her to the meeting.
Right. No.
No.
I'm sorry. Let me help you with that. Unfortunately, when they call in on a phone, it doesn't go the same as if they use the computer. So they actually stay where they are, but we allow them to speak.
Okay.
We unallow them to speak. So I believe this is Becky Steinbrenner. Are you ready for her to give her comment?
Yeah. If we could put the timer back up on the screen, please. Thank you for your patience, Ms. Steinbrenner. Just one moment. Timer, please. I'm happy to put my timer up on the screen too.
I'm sorry. We just got tripped up with something here. So please stand by. There it is.
No worries. Thank you so much.
Oh, I lost my thing. Hold on.
All right. We're ready.
Okay. All right, Ms. Steinbrenner, you're on mute. There you are.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Becky Steinbrenner. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank you again for your thoughtful discussions on these very important issues. I have great concern about, as you know, about the Pure Water SoCal project in Santa Cruz County, and that there never has been a final anti-degradation analysis done and publicly submitted for that project, which is required by state water law. There also has been no collaboration with California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I've confirmed this many times. The local and the state California Department of Fish and Wildlife officials continually tell me they have no knowledge of this project at all, and there have been no permits applied for that are required for the project by SoCal Creek Water District. So I'm continuing to challenge it legally, but they are continuing to build it. So I need your help in enforcing especially the final anti-degradation analysis that is required. The second issue I want to bring to your board this morning is the groundwater contaminant plume of PCE that has been documented in the Live Oak area of Santa Cruz County. It was discovered when there were some test borings done to prepare for a development at 1500, that's 1500 Capitola Road in Santa Cruz. It was significant in the soil, and it has been established that it is in a plume of groundwater and is traveling. I request your board to help identify the source that could be still the dry cleaners tank that they had buried there. There's been no ground penetrating radar used at the site to establish if maybe they just put a tank that is still buried and still leaking. But again, that project is also moving forward, and sadly, there's been no cleanup. no cleanup, and they're simply going to put a barrier underneath the buildings that will include a low-cost dental clinic, a low-cost medical clinic, and a very low affordable housing unit. There's been no cleanup, and I'm mostly concerned now about the water, the established groundwater pollution plume that is moving toward the production wells for Santa Cruz City.
Ms. Steinbrenner, you're at time.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today and for your comment.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Before we move to the next item on our agenda, I think there's an opportunity to take a break here for 10 minutes before we turn to item number 14, our amendments to the water quality control plan for the Central Coast. Is it the pleasure of my colleagues to take a 10-minute break? Yes, 10, 15 minutes, what's your pleasure? 10 or 15? 10 minutes. All right. So thank you, everybody. We will return in 10 minutes at 10:06. Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, we are recording and broadcasting. The floor is yours.
Thank you. 10:07. Thank you, everybody. We're back in session. The next item on our agenda is item number 14. Mr. Keeling, would you like to introduce the item?
I would. Thank you, Chair Gray. So item 14, this is a proposed resolution for the board's consideration to adopt a proposed amendment to the water quality control plan. And this is to incorporate a total maximum daily loads for turbidity in the Gabilon Creek watershed. Proposed amendments are needed to establish turbidity implementation strategies to control sources and achieve water quality objectives that are protective and beneficial uses. TMDLs are implemented when they're incorporated into permits or approved non-regulatory plans that establish actions needed to achieve the water quality objectives, a schedule for the actions to be taken, and monitoring activities to determine compliance with the water quality objectives. Peter Mertens of our TMDL program staff will be presenting this item, and Mary Hamilton will also be on hand to help answer any questions during the proceeding. So with that, I'll turn it over to Peter Mertens.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Is my screen showing? I'm sharing the screen. It's not sharing.
No, we just see you. Not just, we see you.
Okay.
Not your material.
Okay, it says the host disabled my screen share, so I need to be able to share.
Hold on one moment, let's see what we got going here.
Okay.
I apologize. Oh, you should be able to have it now.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you. All right. Well, good morning, Chair Gray and members of the board. My name is Peter Mertens, and I'm an environmental scientist in the TMDL unit. I'm here today with Mary Hamilton, an environmental program manager with the Central Coast Water Board. And we're here to present this agenda item 14, a proposed resolution to the Central Coast Basin Plan to adopt total maximum daily loads for turbidity in the Gabilon Creek watershed. In this presentation, I'm going to go over key components of the TMDL, of this turbidity TMDL project that are listed on this slide. To get started, I'd like to go off by explaining these TMDL components in general terms. We have some new board members, and also it's been a little while since we brought a TMDL to the board. So just to give a little overview, the TMDL projects include a description of the water quality problems and the watershed. An initial step in the TMDL development is to analyze water quality monitoring data and characterize the turbidity impairments. Along with identifying water quality problems, sources of turbidity are identified in the watershed. To restore water quality and to meet water quality standards, numeric targets are established. Total maximum daily loads, referred to as TMDLs, are also established for each water body. To meet the TMDLs, the sources of turbidity in the watershed receive allocations of the pollutant, in this case, turbidity. TMDLs are not self-implementing, and the TMDL implementation plan describes the mechanisms that will be used to restore water quality. The implementation plan includes a schedule with interim milestones and a final attainment date. A TMDL project also includes extensive public outreach and a public comment period. The turbidity TMDL project is located in the 160 square mile Gabalon Creek watershed, which is shown in this map on the left. At the center of this watershed is the city of Salinas. The watershed extends from the southwestern slope of the Gabalon Mountains west to the Pacific Ocean. The Gabalon Creek is the major stream that flows out of the watershed, and in the city of Salinas, it connects up and forms the Salinas Reclamation Canal, which in turn connects up with Tembladero Slough, flows to Old Salinas River, and then outlets into Moss Landing Harbor and the Pacific Ocean. So turbidity is a measure of water clarity and is reported as nephelometric turbidity units. Turbidity is linked to suspended sediment and other suspended particles, and the figure on the right illustrates turbidity ranging from 10 to 250 NTU. For reference, clean freshwater streams have near zero turbidity unless there is stormwater runoff or other disturbance. A guideline used to evaluate turbidity levels for the 303D list is 25 NTUs, which is high enough turbidity to interfere with a fish's ability, such as steelhead, to find and see prey. Turbidity also reduces the amount of light that enters a water body and limits plant and algal growth. All right. This watershed has been extensively monitored, and streams in the lower Gabalon Creek watershed are the most turbid in waters in the region. Monitoring samples frequently exceed guidelines and at extremely high levels year round. So this table summarizes the turbidity impairments from some of the major water bodies in the watershed. The table lists water bodies, number of samples, the percent exceedance, median turbidity levels. So in this watershed, we have a large number of samples and a high percentage that exceeded the guidelines. We also have very high median levels, which is the midpoint in the turbidity of that range of samples. So these are very, very high numbers. For example, the Old Salinas River channel at the base of the watershed near the coast was sampled 299 times, 81% exceeded the guideline. And that's the guideline of, you know, that we've talked about of 25 NTU. Actually, in this water body, not quite 25 NTU, but exceeded the guideline, and the median is over 70. Natividad Creek was sampled 164 times, and 88% of the samples exceeded its guideline and the median of 100 NTU. 100 NTU is illustrated on the right, and that is 25 times the guideline of Natividad Creek. The Gabalon Creek watershed is highly modified, and this map on the right illustrates the lower watershed with extensive agriculture, the urban area of the city of Salinas in the center, and it's, you know, highly developed area. And the so in this part of the TMDL process, we identified the sources of turbidity, and sources of particular concern are irrigated agriculture, urban stormwater, and the pump discharges, as well as degraded streams and channels. The photos in this slide illustrate sources of turbidity in the watershed. Photos 1 and 2 in the upper left were taken during the winter and illustrate potential sources of erosion from farm fields with bare soils, road runoff into unstable roadside ditches, and stream bed and bank erosion. Photo 3 in the upper right was taken after a rain event this fall and shows how turbid runoff from upland fields into urban runoff can be. into urban areas. Photo 4 at the bottom left is an example of an urban stormwater outfall. Photo 5 in the middle of the lower row is an example of a stream without vegetation that is prone to bank erosion and resuspension of stream bed sediments. Photo 6 in the right is an example of an agricultural pump that discharges into a creek. Pumps are used to prevent ponding and flooding. Some pumps operate year-round in the lower watershed and contribute to turbidity. To address turbidity impairments, the TMDL project establishes turbidity numeric targets for 3 different geographic areas in the watershed. The upper watershed headwaters on the right side of the map, and is circled on the right side. The lower Gavilan Creek watershed above brackish waters is circled in the middle. And then on the left, the lower brackish waters of Old Salinas River and Tembladero Slough are circled. This table summarizes the interim and final turbidity numeric targets as NTU for the 3 different geographic areas of the Gavilan Creek watershed that were shown in the previous slide. So there's a lot of information in this slide. And so what I'm gonna do is explain it to you in stages and then go over the numbers. So let me kind of explain the components of this table, and then I'm gonna circle and go over different parts of it to kind of help explain. So we'll take a few minutes to kind of go over this. The first column is the geographic areas that I just showed in the previous map. And then then there's the interim targets and we have dry and wet season targets, and then the final targets on the far right. Okay, so now I'm gonna go over some of the different targets. So looking at this first interim target level for the upper Gavilan Creek watershed, which is this first row. There are actually no interim targets because this water's in less disturbed condition and there's no evidence of impairment, so we're not going to give it an interim level. For the lower Gavilan Creek watershed, and this is the area, the largest area and of the most concern for stakeholders, is we've got a range of targets based on the 25th percentile of turbidity data for specific water body. So that's why there's a range shown here from 12 to 57 in this first one. And the goal is for these sites to incrementally improve the condition by meeting something that's already occurring there 25% of the time and now meeting it 50%. So the specific targets for each water body's unique interim first target are listed in Table 2 of the Basin Plan Amendment, which is Attachment A to the resolution. The milestones for achieving this first interim target is 7 years. So again, to kind of further explain how this works, I'm going to give an example of a particular water body from that table I just mentioned. So in this photo on the right is Alisal Creek, which is above the city of Salinas and flows in from agricultural areas. So it's actually flowing at us, and then the city's behind us. We were looking. In this example, 25% of the samples that we already have for Alisal Creek at this site are 12 NTU or better during the dry season. Now we're moving it as a target to then achieve that level 50% of the time. And then during the wet season, that site is achieving that level its current level is 72 NTU at 25% of the time, and we're moving it to 50. Or better, 50% of the time or better.
Can we pause here? I'm sorry, Mr. Mertens, can we pause? Does anybody have any questions?
Oh yeah.
Just wanted to make sure, thank you. Yes, I saw some squinting eyes and some quizzical looks, so I was just reading faces. Dr. Wolf, you're on mute, sir.
Thank you, Jane. You can read my facial expressions like an open book. But the question I have for you, Peter, is when we talk about wet season, you know, it's the definition of a wet season. Wet season meaning what, you know, a similar standard as, say, Fish and Wildlife use when we have 401 permits of, you know, entering riparian areas outside of a wet season. Is it that similar base? And then when we talk about wet season, clearly with our discussions about climate change, you know, El Niños, La Niñas, you know, major events like we had not too long ago in December, the terminology here is pretty encompassing, and the impact on turbidity can be very significant when you have these, you know, 50% thresholds like you discussed. So anyway,
yeah,
I mentioned this to sort of frame where my question is about, you know, helping me understand a little bit more what we have in mind when we're saying wet season.
Sure. No, thank you. Yeah, that's great. And that, so again, your first part of your question characterizing wet season. Yes, we're consistent with other programs, particularly stormwater, and I believe with the Fish and Wildlife also in their guidance on seasons. And it's important because of our characterization of our climate on the Central Coast region, and how during those winter months we should be getting the bulk of our rainfall. Statistically, looking at a data set, and then kind of going into the weeds a little, is that we're going to have episodic events, and maybe an El Nino, and yeah, or atmospheric river come through, and that would otherwise skew the data set. But we're looking at medians for our data. So we could have that event and register high levels of turbidity, and then we would still have the storm subsides and water quality returns to a clearer level. And so that's why we allow for a range and look at medians to allow for that upper level event to occur, but still look for a lot of water that's in good condition.
But Peter, that could trigger, though, you know, 1 year you look like a hero, and the next year you look like a zero, even if you normalize the values, unless you spread it over. You know, I'm going to use 10 years. And the reason I use 10 years is that has been the NOAA range of taking dry years, wet years, and a little bit of an equilibrium where the total amount of rainfall is about the same if you take it as a whole decade long. So how do you manage that in the program?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great question also. Yeah, that was taken into consideration, and statistically, we've got an even interval of samples over a period of time, and we need a period of time of samples in order to evaluate it, and that's what we evaluated, and that was actually one of the discussions we had with Sarah Lopez with the monitoring program, is the power analysis and the number of samples to get a valid statistical range. And that also works with our climatic changes and variation from year to year. So the numbers are based on existing data sets and reference conditions that experience those level changes. So we're building off of what we have, and then setting new levels to improve it. So,
thank you.
Yeah, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, appreciate your question. So.
Oh, Mr. Mertensen, how are we incorporating climate change, and is there an opportunity to adjust as rainfall and other types of data changes through the course of this?
Yeah, you know, that's also, I mean, TMDLs and these assessments and the 303D lists are fluid, you know, I mean, literally fluid, I guess. They're, we evaluate and do take into consideration different factors as we evaluate moving forward. Specifically with climate change in this project, I think we have kind of a buffer because we've taken in a large data set to build our reference conditions and look at that. So we're comfortable with the numbers that we developed as solid numeric targets. The goal doesn't, I'm going to get to this, it's like a little spoiler alert for my future slide, but we consider the full water quality standard and not just limit to the new numbers. We're looking at the biological conditions. So one way to build resilience into this watershed is to improve the ecosystem, and we have biological condition targets. And we note in with those that they can be used in lieu of or as a proxy to our numbers for turbidity. If we're getting the health and we're seeing the beneficial use recovery, and we have some turbidity ranges and variations that might be outside of the range that we're looking for, but we've got everything functioning, well, we've met the goal. And we don't want to just be held to that. So we note that in this. Let's look at the whole picture. And again, building that resilience also is helping with carbon sequestration, helping with flood control, and improving the overall ecosystem and environmental health. So I think it's a nice comprehensive TMDL.
Great, thank you, Mr. Mertens. Ms. Hamilton.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Peter, thank you for those points and pointing out the biological targets. It's an important piece of evaluating aquatic health. I did want to mention on the climate change piece and our ability to adjust as seasons may change or other things, two points. TMDLs can be revisited and revised at a future date when additional data and information are available. But almost more importantly, TMDLs are implemented via other mechanisms. So the terms of the permit can define, we can change the seasonality or the length of the wet season, for example, in the terms of the permit, for example. So there are multiple ways we could get at this and ensure that any limits we're establishing in a permit are relevant to the existing conditions.
Thank you, I appreciate that. I mean, we need to be very flexible and responsive to changing conditions. Thank you, Ms. Hamilton and Mr. Mertens.
Yeah, any
other questions before we let you carry on? Go ahead.
my the second interim targets that are circled in this slide. And for the lower Gavilan Creek watershed, again, which is the, you know, an area of most concern, we've set levels of 12 and 21 NTU. So 12 during the dry season and 21 during the wet season. And these are based on conditions in other agricultural watersheds that we used as reference, and so that are being met in other agricultural watersheds. And then we're working to achieve and improve this one. And lastly, these are the final numeric targets, and they're based on natural conditions of reference sites in the region. For example, the lower Gavilan Creek waters above the above the brackish habitats are 6 NTU in the dry season, 11 in the wet season, and 8 year round, again as median. And we were not able to set targets for this brackish watered area in the lower watershed, which we don't have enough data from healthy watersheds and sites in order to do that. So that's something that still needs to be developed. And as we touched upon, the TMDL also establishes biological condition numeric targets.
Mr. Mertens, I'm sorry to interrupt you again.
Okay.
Dr. Wolf has a question.
Yes, sorry. And, you know, and I appreciate Chair Gray, you know, the opportunity to ask questions as the presentation progresses, because it makes it more relevant at the time. Thank you for that. Mr. Mertens, On the earlier slide, you said we don't have data on brackish water. And I guess I was pausing on that.
I did a lot, you know, we did, again, digging into the weeds a little bit, we did an extensive evaluation of other sites with similar habitat and brackish conditions in the region. It was difficult to find a large enough data set to establish a reference levels that we felt could be used for targets in this watershed. So if we had a paired watershed that was really pristine and, or not really, you know, in better condition, it doesn't have to be necessarily pristine, that we felt comfortable using as a reference, we could then apply that to this watershed and say, these are similar characteristics, similar settings, geologically, hydrologically, that we could use. So
if we don't have any reference point, how can we then have an interim target 2, for example? What would it be based on?
Well, interim target 2 was based on the best of what we had there. So what we did is took we took the interim 1 levels and the best quality of those and applied them to both water bodies for interim target 2. So essentially, again, they're able to get to these levels 25% of the time, and these are impaired. Let's move them up. Let's get them up to 50% of the time at the level that's existing there. And it's then warrants additional study to see about developing, you know, it's a complex system in a brackish environment, especially because we have tide gates in this lower area. So you've got mixing of salt and fresh waters. So we need to be a little more, it needs probably a little research study to determine. Beyond our scope.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, thank you for letting me dig in and explain this. Okay, so, and again, moving forward, looking at biological conditions as an indicator, as a good stock, you know, as a really good point of reference of this is a functioning healthy system. So, and two good metrics are these macroinvertebrate taxa richness, which is basically bugs in the creeks. And that's the bottom. Well, these really two look at the crux of the ecosystem. If it's plants growing and can function there and we have insects, we've got a healthy system. And then, you know, clearer water for the fish to migrate through and live in. So those are the factors that we added in. And the nice thing with both of these metrics is they're well established and have good scoring systems that we can use for evaluating. All right, so then moving forward towards implementation, you know, to achieve our targets, the TMDL process, we identify sources, and those sources are assigned allocations, either waste load or load allocations. I mean, essentially they're the same. I was talking to my coworker and he said, why don't you just explain them as allocations? And then he's like, well, they're, because for point sources, they get waste load allocations and it's usually factors with NPDES permits. Well, it is with NPDES permits. If there was a wastewater treatment plant, they would have a point source in this watershed, but there isn't one. But urban stormwater, construction and highways like Caltrans have waste load allocations and are point sources.
Mr. Mayor, sorry. I'm gonna just be interrupting you. And I appreciate you allowing us to do that. I do think it helps with the dialogue. We don't need to have pent up questions and then non sequiturs as we move through at the very end. So Dr. Hunter has her hand raised.
Oh, sure. Okay, great.
Yeah, I appreciate that because this is, Peter, this is an enormous amount of work and information. And I think it is clear that the level of complication here, if we can target our questions in the moment, I think it's also helpful to the public trying to comprehend how this TMDL was structured and all the data and analysis and details that you have brought to bear. So I just want to acknowledge all the work that you've done.
Well, and before you, I just actually enjoyed talking and communicating in this fashion as well, you know, I could give the speech, but this is totally do not apologize. You don't need to apologize anymore. I much prefer having a dialogue and not reading my script so much.
Good.
I might make a lose my spot a little bit, but overall,
Well, I'm sure you have this really in mind, deeply in mind. Anyway, I my question just really is a pretty light one, given the topic. We're really aware of the urban stormwater programs, and of course the ag inputs is major. But in some of the materials that I read in the packet for this item, highways was also discussed. And considering that Highway 1 runs through that area, I believe. There are other highways that are under county or state authority. How well have they done in recognizing these the priority or their responsibility in reducing their waste load allocations?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I mean, we did have a comment letter from Caltrans, and that's in the record that they were asking for to be drawing a blank on the not given an allocation, essentially, and not seen as a significant source. And we commented back that we do, you know, there's concerns of vehicles tracking materials and the impervious surfaces. Mm-hmm. Then we've actually had engaged quite a bit with the County of Monterey regarding rural roads, they've been receptive to talking to us and understanding how they would, you know, we would need to develop a non-point source plan. So we did have several email exchanges and conversations with them about that. And I think that's an area that's outside of stormwater boundaries, mm-hmm. but this needs to be addressed through a non-point source program.
I'm glad to hear that. We don't, you know, we have so much, it's so overwhelming in certain land use categories that often, you know, this area is kind of overlooked. But to me, it is piecemeal, and every little tiny piece contributes to this reduction, overall reduction. So I'm glad to hear you've already engaged with the two major entities on road maintenance and improvements. So good to hear.
Oh, yeah, thanks. All right.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter. Dr. Wolf?
Thank you. So indulge me on this question. Turbidity sources, and I know in the brief we discussed the ranking in terms of the contributions. And then we're looking at the endpoint, which is, you know, the significant improvements to turbidity. But all of these turbidity sources are not going to be static, meaning not subject potentially to growth. If we take some of the contributors, let's use agriculture since that's one of the larger contributors. In the modeling, are we looking at potential increase of irrigated ag and cropland where you have conversion of grazing land to irrigated? So that's going to add, you know, some turbidity contributions. So where I'm getting at is when we look at the end result, I assume that it keeps in mind potential growth in some of these sources.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we keep that in mind. It is a very well developed, thoroughly developed watershed. So I don't. We examine land use and land use cover and model that through GIS models and look at the detailed sources. This TMDL is focused on turbidity, however, more than say suspended sediment loading, which we've done in other TMDLs. And that's because we have a lot of resuspension of materials and mobilization. So I thought about your question after you asked it previously, and I missed something, and that's the channel maintenance, channel degradation as a source of turbidity. It's that remobilization of material in these highly degraded channels that's a big factor. And so that when you bring up like the model of the land use and the broader characteristics of the watershed being influenced, which does influence it, it's not as maybe necessarily as strong when we look at turbidity and the cloudiness and the clarity and as something that occurs year round. So it's we have some unusual, it's an unusual system, this one.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so looking at sources and then taking this towards implementation mechanisms. And now you guys got me off my script a little.
Peter, it's okay. Take your time. I mean, honestly, I do think it's really helpful to have this dialogue.
I totally agree.
For the board and for the public, and you know, reorient yourself as needed. So no worries.
Oh, okay, thank you. So as previously mentioned, TMDLs are not self implementing; they're applied through mechanisms. And this slide is one I think it's good to take a minute and look at, because we went through and outlined all the different regulatory mechanisms, and then looked at what mechanism would apply to what type of source. And so as we've talked about, like say rural roads, it's an unusual situation outside of the stormwater permit, and we would need a non-point source program developed to implement that. The same with pumping that is not a permitted or an activity through a stormwater or something that might be moving water in an urban area. So the examples are like, you know, the irrigated agriculture, we've got the ag order, and then we have stormwater permits for urban areas.
I'm sorry, can we just go back to that slide? Because I see IRWM there, which great, I'm always happy with a shout out, but to that program. But, you know, State Board did, you know, promulgate their own stormwater resource planning program with stormwater resource plans consolidated. Those obviously needed to be approved through an IRWM, but those are State Board, you know, adopted plans and might be more embracing and the better plan to be using as it relates to some of these projects. So I don't know if you looked at those.
I have looked at them in regards to the stormwater permits and how they get implemented and integrated into those. The value of IRWM in this situation is that they did a regional stormwater management plan, and they have all these projects that are that we wanted to acknowledge. Basically, it's like we're not really regulating them, but all the agencies we work with participate in IRWM, and they're working towards getting these holistic projects. And also, as a side benefit, I think a lot of I feel like they incorporate disadvantaged communities in areas like recreation and like the Carr Lake project in the center of Salinas, and it's going to build like wetland habitats, but also do recreational trails. So I don't know, those things are just have a nice all-encompassing bringing communities together.
No, and, absolutely. They're definitely multi-benefit projects. I just wanted to make sure that you took a look at, you know, the stormwater resource plans as well that are focused on that, and certainly in tandem with IRWM.
Yeah, no, I'll make note to keep that in mind, because the stormwater, we have other projects coming up too. So thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Hunter?
Just a housekeeping comment. When we zero in on something like that carries a strong acronym that we all know, would be helpful, I think, for those not as familiar, to state the actual name of the program. So IRWM is one we throw around a lot. And it's fine that it's on this page and in this table, but since we zeroed in on it, probably helpful to actually name that program.
Thank you, Dr. Just, Hunter.
Which is, I'm trying to remember, integrated regional water management?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So public outreach is a key component of a TMDL project, and we did an extensive job of public outreach with this project. We did early outreach to groups like Grower Shipper Association and met with them and Farm Bureau. And then we had a kickoff meeting with the general public, and then that encompassed CEQA scoping. We have a large interested parties list that we communicate with, and also made effort to communicate with disadvantaged communities and tribes. So we have a guidance internally here that we work from, and we made effort to contact the Native American Tribal Commission and for lists of contacts in the watershed in the project area, and then we individually send them emails to try to engage them. And then also with disadvantaged communities, we have a list of advocates in the watershed that we work with to, and we communicated with them.
Mr. Martins?
Yes.
We have a question.
Oh, sure.
Dr. Hunter?
Okay.
Okay,
no,
so go
no
ahead.
Need. Pardon me.
Sorry. Okay, and then importantly, we have a comment period, and we had that this fall, and we did public, during that period, we had a public outreach meeting. In addition, we met with probably over a half dozen organizations, groups individually, and to answer questions, discuss the TMDL and get their feedback. So groups like the Sanctuary and the Cooperative Monitoring Program, we reached out to them and to discuss the TMDL, Central Coast Wetlands Group. So a wide range, the county, Monterey County Water Resource Agency. So of the public comments, we received three public comment letters, and I'll take just a brief minute to summarize. So just a couple of comments. I'm gonna just go over a few. And the Monterey County Water Resource Agency notified us that the data they provided are provisional, and we acknowledge that in the documents. The agency also commented on the final numeric targets that they should be based on data in the Gavilan Creek watershed. And staff considered using modern data from the watershed, but this Gavilan Creek watershed was too highly impaired to do that for final targets. Provost and Pritchard Consulting Group represents some farmers in the watershed as well as landowners, and they commented that soil erosivity was not adequately considered. However, the TMDL technical report includes findings from an in-depth study conducted by Cal State Monterey Bay in the watershed, and they did that, as well as we do include some soil factors in our work as well. They asked for clarification on the biological condition numeric targets, and we provided that in the documents. Caltrans also requested that the highways be considered a negligible source. We've already kind of discussed this, and we noted that they, even though they're small, they compared to the entire watershed, they still are a source. So just one final comment. We appreciate the feedback that we got, and all of that taking the time to write these comments is very valuable and definitely helped us improve our project and provide clarification. So,
thank you, Mr. Martins. Dr. Wolf has a question.
Yes.
Thank you. In terms of a source of the public comments, I understand the synergy associated with Monterey County Water Resource Agency, the synergy to the questions or comment with California Department of Transportation. But could you help me understand this consulting group? That was on behalf of who? I assume there is some organization behind who supported the consulting group here to, put together some questions. So can you tell me it's on behalf of who?
The The letter was authored by Kay Mercer with a couple other staff that work for this group. The specific growers and the like breadth of their farming and land ownership in the watershed is not clear. It's not described in that. I mean, Kay Mercer participated in several outreach meetings, and it's not quite clear how many landowners or growers she works represents.
So, but basically was representing a group of agriculturists.
Yes, unknown in scope and size or number.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Oh, okay, so this is my, I have one extra slide after this, but this is my last summary slide. And, you know, it's basically all the surface waters in this lower Gabalon Creek watershed are highly impaired for turbidity. The elevated levels are detrimental to aquatic ecosystems. The TMDL project establishes turbidity numeric targets and a 20-year attainment schedule to achieve the water quality standards. This TMDL project assigns allocations to responsible parties and includes an implementation plan that addresses the sources of turbidity in the watershed, such as irrigated agriculture, urban stormwater pumping, and degraded stream channel conditions. And then in conclusion, the recommendation is for the board to adopt this proposed resolution to amend the water quality control plan for the Central Coastal Basin to adopt total maximum daily loads for turbidity in the Gabalon Creek watershed, Monterey County, California. And then
thank you, Mr. Mertens. I very much appreciate that thorough presentation. And thank you also for letting us interrupt you intermittently to get questions answered. Do we have any other discussion items at the board level? Any other questions that we didn't already pose to Mr. Mertens that we'd like to have answered?
No, I just want to say that myself also, I appreciate the opportunity to go into the weeds, as you refer to, Mr. Mertens, and that helped me because now I'm totally satisfied. I don't have any additional question.
All right.
It's an important dialogue, and it's a very large amendment. And so appreciate the time that you took to go through the item and really just the time that you took to exercise, exemplary stakeholder outreach and engagement, and move through this item. It is certainly very complicated. At this time, I will open up the public comment. Ms. Olson, do we have public speakers for this item?
We have two speakers for this item.
Great. So if we could have the timer up from AGP, we would appreciate that.
Bob? I can use my timer if you'd like.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I was off headset. What's the question?
Could you please put the timer up for us? We are going to public comment at this moment.
I'm so sorry, we're getting that ready now.
That's okay. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, we are ready for our speaker. Thank you for your patience, Ms. Lopez.
Our first speaker is Ms. Lopez.
Okay, good morning. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, great. And I don't need to worry about my video for this comment?
If you'd like to turn it on, we're always happy to see you, but it's completely up to your discretion.
Okay.
It's okay, Ms. Lopez, if you don't want to turn it on, it's fine.
It seems that the Zoom doesn't want you to see me. So in the interest of time, I'll just speak.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Well, good morning. Now Chair Gray, as I understand it, Vice Chair Wolf and Board Member Hunter. I'm Sarah Lopez, Executive Director of Central Coast Water Quality Preservation, Inc. And I'm commenting today on behalf of our members, which are over 1,600 farming operations here on the Central Coast. Our Surface Water Cooperative Monitoring Program for the Ag Order or Irrigated Lands Program generated much of the data that was referenced in this TMDL. And our outreach programs are actively working with the farmers in these watersheds to reduce sediment inputs from agriculture. One comment I wanted to make was just to note for the record that as of 2020, we have statistically significant declining turbidity trends in 12 of our 19 Lower Salinas area ag monitoring sites. I think most of those overlap with this TMDL area. But that said, I concur with Mr. Mertens' presentation. We still have a lot of exceedances, and so there's work left to be done. Another comment I wanted to make was just to acknowledge the enormous amount of effort, technical detail, and data analysis that staff put into this TMDL. It was a lot to wade through, but it was also really impressive, and I do really appreciate their effort to ground their recommendations in data. Another comment was, it's my understanding that power analysis was used, which is a statistical method to assess whether or not the existing monitoring programs are sufficient to continue producing data for this TMDL. And I just wanted to express support for that approach. It's something that we've done in the past at Preservation Inc. And I think you may be hearing more about this from us in the context of the Ag Order. One thing I did want to note, though, is if we're going to use power analysis to sometimes recommend more frequent monitoring, I think objectively we need to be willing to rely on power analysis to let us know when we can reduce monitoring frequency as well. So we should be using those power analyses objectively. Which is not a criticism for this TMDL, it's just something I wanted to bring up. And finally, as I see my time is expiring here, I just wanted to note the nexus of this TMDL with the Ag Order. And I think that it's something that has maybe not been as prominent in past TMDL adoptions, but I think my understanding is that numbers in this TMDL will be translating into the implementation of Ag Order 4.0. And so I look forward to further engagement with this board and staff in that context. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lopez. Thank you for being on time with your comment. And I certainly will be the first also to echo, again, kudos to staff for doing such a great job in the data that forms the foundation of this TMDL. And appreciate you acknowledging sort of the interconnectivity of this TMDL with other programs that we have. Ms. Olson, do we have any other speakers?
We have one more speaker, Kay Mercer. Would you like me to?
Yes, please. Yes. Can you please bring her in?
Kay Mercer, I'm going to make it for you to be allowed to talk. And then if you want to go ahead and start. Just need to unmute yourself.
All right. And so I'm going to go forward with that video also because I don't see the option on my screen. So good morning. Thank you for providing this opportunity to make a comment on the Gavilan Creek Watershed Turbidity TMDL. I'm Kay Mercer with Provost and Pritchard, and I'm making the following comments on behalf of my PNP clients, that's Provost and Pritchard, the clients that are in the project area, but also I am representing clients throughout the Central Coast region because some of the methodologies that you have developed affect the whole region. They are not just limited to the Gavilan. My comments today focus on a couple of ways to improve this TMDL. One thing is turbidity is kind of tricky. It has a lot of causes and the causes can shift. For example, there's extensive evidence in the Midwest that where conservation practices reduce sedimentation, sunlight penetration increased, and there was a subsequent microscopic algal growth in nutrient-rich waters. What this did was it shifted from a sediment-based to an algal-based turbidity. And that has not been adequately addressed in this TMDL. So we could be successful in reducing sediment, still have turbidity, and that has not been modeled or addressed. And I think that needs to be taken into account. This TMDL encompasses creeks that are not listed for turbidity. And the Central Coast region does not have a tributary rule. Therefore, the turbidity TMDL should only apply to watersheds where listings exist, not tributaries or other watersheds in this proposed project area. And so that needs to be, that's probably just a simple titling situation and maybe some wordsmithing. All stakeholder groups have articulated concern with the lack of practices to attain allocations. Staff has responded that attainment is plausible, but that gives us cold comfort when non-attainment will trigger permit limits and consequences. Further, the water board and institutions have institutionally been slow to invest in reduction of turbidity, and therefore these expectations are far ahead of solutions. There's a lack of public discourse regarding the proposed methodologies. I suggest that you have a water board workshop and strip those out of this TMDL until there's a more transparent discussion about how those will apply region-wide. The water board should seriously consider adopting this proposed TMDL allocations that are, should seriously reconsider adopting, because these are unattainable and the USPA frowns on adopting unattainable TMDLs. One way to address this would be to extend longer timelines and hope that the technologies will catch up with the TMDLs applications in the time frame to enable attainment. So I think that's it. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'd welcome any questions if you have some.
Thank you, Ms. Mercer. I appreciate you jumping on today and providing us with comment. Mr. Mertens, did you have anything you wanted to clarify related to any of the comments?
You know what, I'll proceed with questions and then follow up with board questions regarding the comments you heard.
Yes, I don't have any questions. Okay. Do my board colleagues have any questions? Great. Thank you very much. Thank you to our speakers. So at this time, do we have a motion to adopt resolution number R3-2022-0002?
I'll make the motion.
Do I have a second?
I will second.
Thank you. Can we get a roll call vote, please, Ms. Olson?
Chair Gray?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Aye.
Member Harlan?
Aye.
Member Hunter?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the motion carries. We can close this item. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So the next item on our agenda is item number 15. At this point, we can bring this forward and not have a lunch break. And finish us out for the day with the exception of executive officer items. So what's the pleasure of my board colleagues? It is 11:04. We can move to this next item, hear the executive officer's report, or we can take a break. Dr. Hunter.
Yes, I say let's push on through.
Okay. If we're going to push on through, why don't we take a 10-minute break right now? Or let's take a 15-minute break, push on through, and finish the day out. Okay.
Sounds good.
Thank you. So before we go, can we just get a readout from AGP on the number of folks who are attending this morning?
Yes, give me one moment for that.
Thank you.
And we have 13 unique IPs.
Thank you very much. So we will regroup. Let's just round it up to 16 minutes at 11:20. Thank you.
So Bob, are you putting up the break thing?
Bye. It's definitely a Friday.
That's okay.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are recording and broadcasting, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to this Friday, February 18th meeting. It's 11:20. We are back in session. The next item on our agenda is item number 15, consideration of proposed amendments to the Water Quality Control Plan for the Central Coast Basin to improve and clarify waste discharge prohibition language. Mr. Keeling, can you provide us a little bit more illumination on the issue?
Yes, thank you, Chair Gray. Yeah, you're correct. It's a consider adopting a proposed amendments to the Water Quality Control Plan. And again, this is via a resolution for the board's consideration. The proposed amendments are intended to improve the effectiveness of our water quality protection related land to disturbance activities and for specific types of waste discharges into waters of the state. I'd like to point out that we issued a supplemental sheet for this item last week, and accompanying that supplemental sheet is attachment 6. The purpose of that supplemental sheet is to kind of clean up and bolster the administrative record for this item as it relates to late comments that we received when we were originally planning to propose this amendment to the basin plan to the board back in 2020 that resulted in us pulling the item in that time and making changes to the proposed amendment that's before you today. So the attachment 6 that supports that supplemental sheet includes kind of an overview of the primary comments and staff responses and the changes that resulted to the proposed amendment. And then also at the end of that supplemental sheet are the entirety of the comment letter that was submitted to us. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mary Hamilton, who will be presenting this item, and also available today to assist her if needed is Taya Tryon and Stephanie Yu. Take it away, Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Keeling. Give me just one moment to share my screen. Is that visible to the board?
It is, yes, thank you.
Thank you. Great. And as Matt mentioned, I'm Mary Hamilton, an environmental program manager of the Central Coast Water Board. And these proposed amendments to the basin plan or the water quality control plan for the Central Coastal Basin are to improve and clarify our waste discharge prohibition language. Mr. Keeling mentioned that I am accompanied by Taya Tryon as well as our counsel. And I would just like to give you a brief overview of the agenda package so you could follow along if you would like to look at the specific documents. And then I'll provide an overview of the project, walk you through some of the proposed amendments, discuss our public outreach and comments and how those were addressed and improved the current version of the proposed amendments, and then discuss next steps should the board adopt these amendments today. So in your package and attached to the staff report, you have attachment 1, the resolution, and attachment A to the resolution is a mock-up of the basin plan showing an underlined strikeout the proposed amendments. Also, attachment 2 is the project report for this project, and that contains details about the need and justification for each of the proposed amendments. Also in attachment 2 is the CEQA checklist for this project. And then Mr. Keeling already mentioned the supplemental sheet notifying you of the addition of the comment letter from 2020, and I'll talk about that in a little more detail in just a moment. So a little background on the basin plan. It was first adopted in 1975, and it is the Central Coast Water Board's foundational document forming the basis for our regulatory and non-regulatory actions to protect waters of the state and ensure compliance with applicable federal and state laws. The basin plan designates beneficial uses such as drinkable, fishable, swimmable, and different aquatic habitat types to all waters of the state. So that includes both groundwaters and surface waters. The basin plan also defines water quality objectives that are necessary to protect or achieve those those beneficial uses. And the basin plan includes programs of implementation. One of those implementation strategies is prohibitions on certain types of waste discharges, such as oil or a specific category of pollutants, or it can be prohibitions to specific areas or a specific water body, such as a prohibition to the Monterey Bay Prohibition Zone. The Water Corps provides us with the authority to amend the basin plan and to establish prohibitions. And it's worth noting that unlike TMDLs from item 14 that do require an implementing mechanism such as a permit, prohibitions are self-implementing, not requiring an additional mechanism. I also wanted to touch on the trainer review. And you may recall that in December, this board heard the trainer review of the basin plan, which is a compilation of needed amendments or suggested amendments to the basin plan to improve its effectiveness. And the board adopts a resolution identifying the priority proposals for future basin plan amendments that staff will work on in the near future. And so in December 2020, the board adopted 8 proposals that we are already starting to work on. This set of proposed amendments before you today addresses 3 of the high priority projects identified as part of the 2017 trainer review. So a little overview of the proposed amendments before I jump into them and walk you through some of them. They're a mix of editorial changes to make the basin plan more clear and user-friendly, such as adding a map that shows where the Monterey Bay Prohibition Zone is, or consolidating information that was redundant in multiple sections of the basin plan into one place. It also includes revisions to clarify the prohibition language scope or the circumstances under which the prohibitions apply. And we propose adding new prohibitions for specific types of waste discharge. So in the next few slides, I'll go over some of the not, or all of the non-editorial proposed amendments. Starting with the land disturbance prohibition, and if you are referencing the mock-up document, this is on page 5 of attachment A to the resolution. We propose several changes to this section of the prohibitions because it was both not specific enough and yet included details that are not necessary. And so first, we propose to clarify the scope and explicitly state that this prohibition only applies to unauthorized discharges, meaning that this prohibition does not apply to a discharger complying with a water board order that regulates the discharge, nor does it apply to a discharge that's exempt from obtaining waste discharge requirements pursuant to the water code or basin plan. Second, we propose to clarify that this prohibition applies to all waters of the state by replacing the phrase "into any stream in the basin" with the phrase "into any waters of the state." To be clear that this applies to multiple water body types, streams, rivers, creeks, wetlands as defined by the dredge and fill policy, et cetera. Next, the current language mentions examples of soil disturbance activities like timber harvesting or construction activities, but also states and other soil disturbance activities. So we propose to simplify by simply removing those examples and make it clear that it applies to all soil disturbance activities. And then finally, the current language also mentions activities occurring in accordance with best management practices. But because management practices are implemented via permits and therefore are not subject to the prohibition, we propose removing this language as well. Also in the land disturbance prohibition, still on page 5, if you're looking at the mock-up document, we propose removing land disturbance prohibition exemptions for agricultural activities. Removing these exemptions is necessary because we have ample water quality data, observations, discharge complaints documenting that agricultural soil disturbance activities do cause or threaten to cause pollution.
Ms. Hamilton, we have a question.
Okay.
Yeah, and I had my hand raised on the previous slide.
Let me back up for you.
Thank you.
Let's see if this rolly ball will cooperate.
All right.
There we go.
All soil disturbance activities and some of the counties within the Central Coast region have what is called grading ordinance specific to agriculture. So how does that coordinate with our overall basin plan? So basically what we're saying is now is that all existing grading ordinance within counties of the Central Coast will have to follow the basin plan amendment?
I don't know. There's an important distinction here, and that is that anyone complying with an order, a water board order that regulates the discharge, is not subject to these prohibitions. So agriculture growers who are enrolled and complying with the soil and erosion management requirements in the ag order, for example, they are not subject to this prohibition. And our authorities apply to discharges into waters of the state or that threaten discharges into the state. So regardless of the county ordinance, it's when there is a threat or a observed impact that our authority applies. And so only a grower, for example, who is not complying with the soil and erosion management requirements in the order would be subject to this prohibition.
Okay.
Dr. Wolf, I would also add that the discharge of, or the soil disturbance activity would need to be discharging this waste in quantities that are deleterious to the beneficial uses. So there's a double threshold. It's not an automatic prohibition entirely.
Okay, thank you for the clarification, both Ms. Yu and Ms. Hamilton.
Thank you, Ms. Yu.
And thank you, Ms. Hamilton, go ahead.
And like Peter, I enjoy the dialogue as well, so please feel free to let's stop and talk if there's questions.
Yeah, I imagine we will. This is, again, you know, a very large item with a lot of impact. So I'm sure we'll be stopping you along the way and appreciate you in advance letting us know that you're okay with that. Thank you.
My pleasure. So the exemptions related to agricultural activities that are currently in the basin plan include exemptions also in the land disturbance prohibition section on page 5 for activities on slopes greater than 30% or activities carried out in accordance with a farm plan that is approved by a resource conservation district or the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The land disturbance prohibition section also references additional exemptions in section 536 of the basin plan, and those are on page 14 of attachment A. And that exemption is for sediment discharges from routine agricultural operations. So again, we propose removing these exemptions because we have ample evidence of harm or potential harm to beneficial uses from these types of activities, and any grower complying with the agricultural order requirements for sediment and erosion control is not subject to this prohibition or these exemptions. Okay, I'm moving on now to page 15 in the mock-up document. And these are new prohibitions proposed to be added into the basin plan. We propose adding numbers 4, 5, and 6 to this section. And number 4 is a proposed amendment to add a prohibition on unauthorized discharges of sediment, well development water, and construction dewatering water. And these are needed because we have observed one-time discharges of this nature into waters of the state, but these discharges really need permit coverage so that we can ensure that the water that is being discharged meets our water quality objectives and would not cause harm to beneficial uses. Numbers 5 and 6 prohibit unauthorized discharges into a stormwater conveyance unless it is 100% stormwater, and discharges of sewage into waters of the state or into a stormwater conveyance. Okay, moving on to section 542, which is also on page 15 of the mock-up. We recommend amendments to this section to clarify that the prohibitions apply to unauthorized discharges into inland waters of the state. So we're adding the phrase unauthorized discharges and tidying up the language where it was inconsistent before. It would say inland surface, it would say inland waters or surface waters. And so we are just clarifying each throughout that is inland surface waters of the state.
Ms. Hamilton, we have another question. Dr. Wolf, please.
On the previous slide, Ms. Hamilton, the prohibition of sewage to waters of a state, isn't that sort of implicit? I'm just thinking it's like, okay, you cannot dump sewage in water of a state. You know, similar to say, you can't take your leftover pesticide and dump them in water of a state. I don't know. I just thought that was so. Where do we stop? You know, because that would be dangerous, you know, to do that.
It's a fair question, and this specific prohibition is. I think you said obvious.
I called it implicit.
Implicit, thank you. I was trying to think of the word you use. I'm like, that's not what he said. You know, the specificity of the specific types, adding specific types of discharges makes it more clear what our authority is. And so if something were discharged without permit coverage, not that we would permit raw sewage discharges into a creek, but having this prohibition allows us to regulate those one-time discharges that occur without permit coverage and better protect our beneficial uses.
Yeah, I'll leave it alone, but I'm just thinking the list can be very long. You know, you cannot dump chemicals. I think it was a year and a half ago in an accidental discharge of a winery into a creek. That's not in the basin plan, but again, it's implicit. That's a violation. So I was just bringing it into that context. But maybe then what you're saying to me is by using the sewage, it basically is sort of a guidance, an example, rather than only applies to sewage?
No, this isn't a specific type of waste discharge that we are proposing to prohibit, specifically sewage into waters of the state or stormwater conveyance. And you're right, the list could be very long. And we will evaluate the priority of and the need for additional specific waste discharge prohibitions in the future and bring those to you as needed.
Mr. Keeling, did you have something to add?
Well, actually, I was going to ask to see if either Ms. Tryon or Ms. Yu can help elucidate, response to Vice Chair Wolf's question more clearly. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, and this relates potentially to municipal wastewater collection system overflows that result in discharges in cases perhaps where the municipality does not have coverage under sanitary sewer overflow general order and our ability to effectively enforce against these types of discharges.
Yeah, I was going to point out, this is Taya Tryon, Assistant Executive Officer. I was going to point out that the enforcement mechanism for pursuing egregious discharges that impact beneficial uses of waters of the state are different when they are prohibited versus just discharge without the prohibition. There's different sections of the water code you use for enforcement to address one-time discharges. You the ability for enforcement on when it is a prohibition is much more clear-cut than if you don't have the prohibition.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you, Ms. Tran. And Dr. Wolf, just for your awareness, I wanted to point out we do have if you will, a more catch-all for hazardous discharges that are hazardous to human, animal, plant, and aquatic life. That's prohibition number one in section 541. However, having a more specific type of waste discharge is obviously easier, not easier, clear, more clear for staff to interpret when using a prohibition to regulate.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Can carry on, Ms. Hamilton, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Okay, I believe I covered this, that we were clarifying 542 to tidy up the inconsistencies and ensure that it says inland surface waters of the state throughout and add the phrasing unauthorized discharges to this section. And with that, that is the extent of our proposed amendments that are not just editorial in nature. And so next I will discuss the public engagement related to this project and the evolution of the project as a result of public input. Did we have any other questions before I move on to the public engagement part?
Thank you for pausing. I don't have any hands up.
Great.
Thank you.
So throughout the process, we did conduct various outreach efforts and provide opportunities for public participation, including tribal outreach, both in 2018 at the initiation of this project and again in 2020 as the project was evolving. We held a public scoping meeting for our CEQA scoping document in late 2018 and had six interested persons participate in that scoping meeting. We also held two different public comment periods for this project. The first in January of 2020. And although we did not receive any comment letters during the public comment period, we did receive a late letter, and that letter warranted consideration. And so the board chair accepted the letter into the record, and staff considered those comments and made additional revisions to the proposed amendments and the supporting documentation in response. I'll summarize some of those comments in general. The main comments were the scope of the prohibitions was unclear, and so we revised to be explicit that they only apply to unauthorized discharges that are not otherwise exempt by the water code or basin plan. Another comment was that the new prohibitions to all waters of the state were overly broad. And so to the discussion we were just having, we identified very specific types of waste discharges and revised that section. And then other comments requested additional justification or explanation for the other proposed amendments, which we provide in the project report, which is attachment two to the staff report. So staff then facilitated a second public comment period on the revised proposed amendments last fall. And during that comment period, we did meet with interested persons to answer questions and discuss the project and the changes. And we did not receive any public comment letters during that September 2020, 2021 public comment period. We did, however, make some minor changes. We did change the proposed amendment slightly to further clarify the scope and be really explicit about the fact that unless authorized or exempt by the water code or basin plan. And we also included clarifying language in the project report and staff report to clearly state that a discharger complying with a water board order regulating the discharge or a discharge that's exempt from obtaining waste discharge requirements pursuant to the water code or basin plan, this prohibition does not apply in those instances. So the public comments really help us clarify and be really explicit in what the scope of these prohibitions are. And so should the board adopt these proposed amendments, the next steps would be obtaining state board approval, Office of Administrative Law approval, and US EPA approval before we would amend the basin plan and publish a revised version.
Ms. Hamilton, should this be adopted today, then what's the timeline associated with the rest of these steps?
Thank you. It takes at least 3 months before we can go to state board for approval. And so I would imagine 4 at least. And then Office of Administrative Law, it depends. I would say 60 days. You know, I think it's, Stephanie, may I ask you, do you know if there's a limit on the amount of time they may take, or is that EPA?
I think they both do. I just don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head. I think it is 60 days for OAL, maybe something similar for EPA, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, it is for EPA. And in my experience, it's been about the same for OAL.
So there aren't statutory timelines. These are sort of flexible timelines.
They're regulatory, actually.
Yeah, okay. I can look this up for you. If the board would like, I can certainly check on that.
That would be great. I mean, you've given us sort of a ballpark, and I think that's very helpful. But yeah, it's sequential, clearly, and does take some time to get through the process. Vice Chair Wolf.
So thank you, Chair Gray, because that triggers a question then for me. If State Board or Office of Administrative Law or USCPA make changes, does this come back to us, or the train left the station and then whatever the other three agencies recommended or requested change I made that gets implemented by our staff, and then this amendment takes place?
Yes, they may recommend changes at any level, and depending on the nature of those changes, it may or may not need to come back to the regional board for approval. Often it's administrative type things, which we can simply move forward with.
Okay, thank you.
You can carry on. Nobody else has raised their hand. Thank you.
So I will just conclude by saying that these amendments will improve the effectiveness of water quality protection and fulfill 3 high priority proposals identified in the 2017 triennial review of the basin plan. And that brings me to the recommendation to adopt proposed resolution number R3-2022-0001. Adopting the proposed amendments to the basin plan to improve and clarify our waste discharge prohibition language.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. It's gratifying to see a 1970s document be updated with some clarifying information. And also the process that you went through is very solid. Do any of my board colleagues have questions or comments? Yes, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. And to Ms. Hamilton and her staff, we're glad to see these amendments moving forward. It seems to be a very time-consuming or time-rich process. I'm guessing a public outreach on this process is one factor that is that makes it more difficult, more complicated, especially given that you had 2 public comment periods in this particular set of amendments. I'm curious, and I mentioned this to staff earlier, we have gained in our ability to conduct outreach to underrepresented communities. And more recently, I think we've had more focus on tribal communities. Some of the regions have a much more visible and strong tribal community presence, which makes it, I think, which facilitates the ability of our staff to engage and receive input from tribal communities. In this region, I think we have not had as much success, and I note that certified letters were sent to 2 identified tribal entities. And I'm curious about that number it would seem to me there would be a few more than two tribal groups in the Central Coast region. And I think your documentation on the process and the information that you use to identify tribal groups is made clear in the staff report. But I would just, I'm just asking for some comment on how outreach to tribal groups can be enhanced and expanded as we move forward in our environmental justice, through our environmental justice priorities. I think with the added emphasis coming from State Water Board and expanded staff there in public outreach and focus on tribal entities in particular. So if you had if you have anything to add on that, that would be really helpful.
Thank you for that question. Very important. And we did conduct tribal outreach, certainly to the tribes who have requested formal consultation. And as you mentioned, that requires a certified letter to those tribes. We also contacted every single tribe that was provided, that contact information was provided by the Native American Heritage Commission throughout the entire region, and sent them an informal invitation to engage, just briefly summarizing the project, give them a gist of what's going on here, and that if they'd like to contact us, here's how you reach us, and we would like to engage with you. And so that's the extent of the tribal outreach. We did not receive any requests for further engagement. And that is a process we've adopted for the Basin Planning and Team Deal group. And so Peter, for example, for item 14, same process. In terms of our region's outreach, I think the board is aware that Ms. Schroeder has worked as our environmental justice coordinator and created a guidance document for our region to implement outreach to EJA groups. And we certainly follow that guidance and are constantly thinking about how we can improve that and improve our engagement with tribes, for example, on that level. I would like to let the board know that we do have a TMDL under development for nutrients in the San Ynez watershed, which includes the Chumash Casino's wastewater treatment plant discharge, which is regulated federally. However, we will be engaging because it is part of our TMDL watershed. And so that will be our first opportunity to work with a discharger who is, in fact, a tribe. So with that, I see Stephanie's hand is up, and perhaps Angela would like to add to give the board a little more understanding of what we have going on currently.
Thank you, Mary.
Actually, my comment is not related to tribal, so I will let any comments on tribal outreach go first.
Thank you. Ms. Schroeder?
Thanks. I think Mary covered it. I think TMDLs and basin planning are one of the areas where we have pretty deliberate outreach. And as I mentioned yesterday, this is definitely an area that we're looking toward OPP's assistance to increase our tribal engagement. I think as the board members mentioned yesterday, we do a lot of outward outreach, right? We don't often get a lot of response back. And so that's where we're trying to figure out how to increase our level of engagement. And we're looking towards OPP for that assistance.
Yeah, and I'm completely in agreement that, you know, it's building. And I think engaging those groups that are harder to identify, or they're not they're not locale based necessarily. They might be disparate throughout a region of the area, et cetera. That makes it even more complicated. But I think engaging in proactive, just information sharing is a prelude to a different kind of outreach, as Mary pointed out, coming up for the Santa Ynez TMDL, where we would want to engage with the discharger that happens to be also a tribal group. So I think establishing good communication and attempting to establish relations, with these entities is anything adds, you know, to kind of a positive pipeline of information. So I'm glad to see that these are being called out more clearly in our staff reports as well. You know, I don't know how this looks different from, say, 10 years ago. I'm guessing there are some differences. We know more and we have better definition of these smaller communities that are just a little bit harder to delineate, but I'm glad to see them reported out more carefully in the staff reports.
Thanks, Dr. Hunter. We can talk more about it in April when we have a more detailed racial equity item, but I'll mention that our tribal consultation policy that the state water boards developed has really helped to formalize our process and has also helped to formalize the resources that are available, including our engagement with the Native American Heritage Commission. One indicator that I'll mention here is that we do now get more increased inquiries from tribal representatives. They're not necessarily on our board agenda items, which is where we're trying to create some, you know, some relevance, but we are getting more inquiries to us saying, can we get assistance? Can we get support? So that's a good positive sign.
Yeah, that is very good to hear. Thank you. Yeah. Okay.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Hunter. That's a very salient point. Angela, don't jump off too quickly, because I did want to sort of expand on a couple of items here. So, you know, I'm encouraged to hear that there is more interface and there's more feedback coming in. It's my understanding that the lens of state board in outreach to tribal governments and tribal communities is through the lens of that racial equity component. So it certainly has been elevated through that. And Dr. Hunter, you brought up a really important point that, you know, tribal governments and tribal members still have a very close connection to resources, although they might not live in that area where they once did. So that, you know, brings a different component when we're talking about how we both outreach to and how we dialogue with tribal members about those, you know, about water, which is a really sacred natural resource. And someone might not live in that region anymore, but still has a very strong connection to it. So it brings in a different level of understanding and engagement. And so appreciate you bringing that up, Ms. Schroeder and Dr. Hunter, for you also addressing that. And certainly with the San Ynez Band, I think that'll be a good opportunity. That is a federally recognized tribe. And I believe that's the only one in the Central Coast region, but there certainly are other tribes that are not federally recognized within our jurisdiction. Thank you. That's all I have on that. Ms. Yu, did you have something you'd like to share unrelated to the tribal discussion?
I do. Thank you, Chair Gray. I wanted to follow up with you about the timing of OAL, Office of Administrative Law review, and also USEPA review of basin plan amendments. So the Office of Administrative Law has 30 working days after it receives submittal of the basin plan amendment to approve or not approve the amendment. And then after that, the state has 30 days to convey it over to the USEPA, which then has 60 days to approve, or if it's going to not approve, 90 days to do that. And if it doesn't approve, it would relay the changes that need to be made in order to have it be have a satisfactory document.
Thank you, Ms. Yu. That's actually more encouraging. They're a little bit tighter timeframes. So that's good to hear.
Yep. Thank you, Ms. Yu. Much appreciated.
So do we have any other questions or comments from my board colleagues on this item? That's very substantive and very much appreciated to be brought forward. Seeing none, I will ask Ms. Olson if we have public speakers at this time.
We do not have any that have submitted speaker cards for this item.
Okay, I do see a hand up on our attendee list.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to do?
I think we only have one speaker, is that correct? So we have the time. I don't think it's
okay.
I think it's fine to admit that person. We have the timer up. So I think it's okay for 3 minutes.
Okay.
And then Ms. Steinbrenner, if you can follow up with the speaker card on the back end so that we have it for our record, that would be very helpful if you could email this in. Thank you.
You can go ahead and unmute yourself.
Thank you very much. This is Becky Steinbrenner. Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Hello?
Yes,
we can hear you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I am never successful in using the online speaker card protocol, so my apologies. I appreciate the report here this morning about this issue. I wonder, as a member of the public, if these prohibitions are only for non-permitted discharges, how does the public know what is permitted and what is not? And also, what is the process for the public to inquire about that? I think that would be a wonderful thing to include in all of this, because it is the eyes and ears of the public out there watching that really brings these things to light. And when we make a request or a complaint, if it has to go that way, how do we do that? And what is the water board's response? What is the timeline? And what is the process? If it is indeed not a permitted discharge, is it an immediate cease and desist? What is the process? I know that the water board a couple of years ago recently changed the policy such that the developers or the construction company is essentially self-regulating by submitting reports and things. But what is the oversight of that, other than the eyes and ears of the public? I'm concerned specifically about the Aptos Village project. Developers in Aptos Village have submitted comment for item number 16 about that. How do we know? How do we know? They're not being transparent at all about that whole new discharge into Aptos Creek that will drain the parking lot runoff into Aptos Creek. My other concern is regarding Soquel Creek Water District's proposed 123 TCP treatment project, where they will develop.
I'm sorry, Ms. Steinbrenner, are you speaking related to the item in front of us? This is not public forum.
Okay.
I have to ask you to really restrict your comments to the item we're talking about.
I appreciate that. I'm just giving some examples of how the public's eyes and ears are really the water board's best friend to make sure that your regulations are being implemented. So what is the public process? And that can
Ms. Steinbrenner, your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I'm now going to bring it back to the board, if we don't have anything further from my board colleagues, to adopt proposed resolution number R3-2022-0001. Do I have a motion for approval?
Chair Gray, yes. Can I ask for a pause on that? I think Ms. Steinbrenner, pose some really basic questions about the public process in terms of how do we know if a discharge is permitted, and how would they report an illegal or a discharge that is of concern to them that seems out of order. And I think hopefully there's some simple answers or some follow-up with staff that could occur. I think this is an easy point to perhaps provide some information, instruction to public that may find themselves in the position of seeing things that don't seem right and would want to proceed.
Thank you. I'm happy to have that discussion can we adopt the order or not adopt it first before we do that?
Well, it's up to you. If I'm happy to move this item forward.
Would you like to discuss
yes,
it?
Yes, I will Pryor, do that. I will make a motion to approve order this item for Basin Plan Amendment.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
I'll be happy to second that.
Thank you, Ms. Harlan. Can we get a roll call vote, please?
Chair Gray?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Aye.
Member Harlan?
Aye.
Member Hunter?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you, Dr. Hunter. I do believe that it's appropriate to discuss this item and appreciate Ms. Steinbender bringing it up. Ms. Tryon, you had your hand up.
Yes, we actually have a very nice complaint system that members of the public can submit their complaints to. It's through the California Environmental Protection Agency Environmental Complaint System. There's a link to it at the bottom of our homepage, and it is monitored on a regular basis. And I, myself and Tamara Anderson, who's the enforcement coordinator for the Central Coast Water Board, monitor and work with internally or externally to resolve complaints. So I would recommend that any kinds of complaints are submitted via that system.
Thank you, Ms. Tryon. Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, I will add to that that counties have also an enforcement branch and have a hotline. It's an 800 number that they can call and say, hey, I was at this construction site and I see water gushing down the gutter with a lot of mud. I mean, this takes place routinely. And then this often triggers the county then contacting us. And we have had examples not too long ago last year where this gets elevated from, a complaint to the county back to us, and in fact, in some instance, it even involved neighbors using drones to capture and videotape what they saw. So, what I'm suggesting, there's different avenues, the water board avenue and also local county. And actually local county, it's kind of an easy go-to because they can right away look at, hey, that's what's the permit, who is the party who received the permit, et cetera. So just want to add that little clarification.
Thank you. Appreciate all the information, and I appreciate the ability to share that out to address the question raised. So at this time, I'd like to move to administrative item number 16, the executive officer's report. Thank you, Ms. Hamilton and Ms. Tryon and the entire team for bringing that forward. Really important issue.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Keeling.
Thank you, Chair Gray. All right, so I'll just walk you through the executive officer's report real quick, see if you have any questions. The first item I'll just touch on, that's the lead here and the staff report, is in response to Chair Gray's inquiry about an update regarding the Alisol fire that occurred, this was October, I think, was when we were having a meeting and it was raging, and we provided some verbal updates during that meeting and the December meeting. So it just kind of outlined some of the action items that were completed in response to that, particularly as it relates to the Tahigas landfill that the fire burned through and caused some fairly significant damage. The first was there was a sulfuric acid spill associated with some polyurethane tanks that melted. And that acid flowed into Pia Creek, or at least a tributary to Pia Creek, and it was controlled before it got into downstream reaches. And the cleanup operations have come to completion with respect to removing the impacted soil. They were able to recover, as I understand it, a fair amount of the sulfuric acid itself, as was mixed with firefighting water. One of the things that they've also done is gone in and removed and taken soil samples from the creek area and the burned area in particular where they contained that spill. One of the things that has come up is they've also identified PFAS within those soils. There is a benefit of having this kind of a spill immediately adjacent to a landfill. And so what they've been able to do is containerize those soils on site, and they're now using them as part of daily cover, or they will be in that landfill. So those lightly impacted soils will be contained within a lined and ultimately covered portion of the landfill. So they're using them for beneficial purposes there. One of the most significant problems with the fire and the destruction that was caused to the landfill infrastructure were the landfill gas risers. So landfills produce methane, and you have to collect that methane because you have a liner on it, on a cap on it. And so they have risers that come up, collect the methane, and pipes that direct it to a facility that will burn off and safely deal with the methane that's produced. That was one of the first things that the landfill addressed, is getting the gas risers repaired and the landfill gas system back up and running. Some of the ongoing work is associated with revegetation of covered portions of the landfill. So when you have a liner or a cap on top of it, there's a soil layer, and you want to have vegetation on that to prevent erosion and to stabilize that cap. Tahigas landfill is in a canyon. It's got some pretty significant slopes. Landfill also prioritized revegetating some of the higher risk areas of that landfill. And they're in the process of following up and doing additional hydroseeding in some areas, but they also had a significant amount of natural regrowth after the fire and subsequent to some of the rainfall events that we had. And then also with respect to their stormwater runoff collection systems, they did some mitigation measures there as well to make sure that if there was any significant storm events, that any sediment that came off of those slopes would be contained. So they were able to successfully do that. And with the storm events that happened, they had some minor debris flows that were captured within their existing stormwater sediment basins. So we're also working with the county, our staff.
I'm sorry, Mr. Keeling, before you, are you moving to another item? Or Dr. Hunter, do you wanna?
No, also our staff are continuing to work with the county to submit their non-compliance report. So whenever a landfill has issues of non-compliance, they have to file a formal report. Normally we work with them in real time. And in this case, given the emergency response related actions associated with the fire, like we've done previously, we've worked with the landfill and the county folks in real time so that they could do the work that they need to do versus getting us, spending time working on and getting us reports. So, but we're still working with them on buttoning things up as it relates to the regulatory requirements associated with reporting out on the issues that occurred and the steps that they took to correct them.
Thank you.
That completes my update there.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. And as I recall, they responded with alacrity and letting us know what was going on. So that's very helpful.
Yeah.
Dr. Hunter.
Yeah, I was just curious about the report of noncompliance as it relates to fire damage. So just to be clear, so what they are doing is compiling a descriptive list of the damage that occurred relative to the actual structure and construction of the landfill. It's only related to the fire. It is specific to the fire event, or is this something that occurs at a regular basis and this fire reporting is integrated into fire damage is integrated into a regular reporting process? How does that work?
Well, in this case, it's specifically related to the fire event. So for example, you know, the county is required to maintain their landfill gas collection system. The fire damaged it. So now they're out of compliance, you know, not for lack of, you know, sufficient operations and maintenance, but because of the fire. Same thing would apply to the vegetative cover on the cap portions of the line fill. So this is, again, just to emphasize, this is specific to the fire and the damage caused by the fire. If, you know, in the future, it could be caused by other factors and there could be issues of noncompliance that they are required under permit to report out to us.
So landfills report annually to the Water Board on their various maintenance and operations. Is that correct?
I am not sure about the frequency that they report out to us. I think that probably depends on the monitoring reporting program that's associated with the landfill specifically, but they do report to us regularly.
Okay,
so documenting it varies. Compliance, yeah, with their waste discharge requirements.
Okay, all right. So would they, so they do this specific fire damage report. Is it an ongoing progress report? It's a one-time deal, or then it reverts back? What I'm trying to understand is how do they incorporate it into their regular reporting cycle so they don't have two or three tracks going with these special event reports?
So my understanding of the landfill requirements is they have specific general monitoring reporting requirements, but then in instances where they have issues of noncompliance, there's a special reporting requirement associated with that. That is the report of noncompliance.
Okay, thank you, that clarifies.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter. Vice Chair Wolf?
Yeah, I was just gonna augment a little comment is that when looking at fires, such as at the landfill, you also have structure buildings. You know, so it's not always solely the landfill. I just want to remind ourselves that when we have fires are also very wet. And it kind of brings to me my memory where I was a volunteer fireman in Marin County for 5 years. And I remember fires were dirty, hot, and wet. So that's the other part to remember is that quite often you will have significant damage that will be caused from the water being applied, not solely from the fire itself, just as a little reminder.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Vice Chair Wolf. My father used to be an insurance auditor. And he told me one time, he said, when there's a fire in a building, the fire causes less damage than the fire department. Because what the fire department comes in and does is they douse the place, they bust open the roof, they bust open the walls to make sure the water gets everywhere where the fire might be to make sure that it is really out.
Yep, I was an engineer at Station 1, and my duty was to make sure these pumps were delivering as many gallons as possible from the fire hydrant to the booster pump of the engine. And even in these rural areas, I mean, you know, we're not talking a few hundred gallons, it's several thousand gallons that are applied at a time. So just want to kind of add that perspective. And earlier on, our fellow board member, Ms. Harlan, brought up some of the fires in some of the Santa Cruz area. Same thing, a lot of the damage are caused by fighting the fire, not from the flame themselves.
Yeah, it's a necessary evil.
Absolutely.
Okay, anything else on the Alisal Fire Tahigas landfill update?
No, I appreciate you putting it up for us. I know that we've talked about it and I appreciate you responding to the request. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think it's always important to follow up on stuff like that. So thank you. The next item that we have a little write-up for in the staff report is just a racial equity initiative update. So if you recall, when we had our racial equity primer in December, you know, we talked about trying to target this meeting to bring to you and have a discussion about our regionally specific racial equity, a draft racial equity resolution. So we were overly optimistic that staff would be able to complete the internal engagement work that they planned on doing over the holidays because of people being on vacations. So we wanted to make sure that we provided ample opportunity to do a really effective internal engagement. So that took a little bit longer than we had initially anticipated. And so now staff have completed that internal engagement. They're in the process of doing kind of an internal evaluation and assessment of that engagement and what that says about informing our next steps in developing a draft racial equity resolution. We had a presentation on it at a recent management team meeting, and we'll also be revisiting it as part of our next all staff meeting to kind of loop back with all staff and saying, okay, here's the feedback that we got through the informal survey that we did and through our direct engagement during your programmatic meetings. To just kind of ground truth it and see if there's any additional feedback that we can get from staff. Staff have also developed an external engagement strategy that they're getting ready to implement and are looking at putting together a working group of outside stakeholders, interested persons that would like to be part of a kind of a discussion panel to help inform our next steps as well. So that'll be underway shortly. Staff have already developed kind of a, what I would call a straw man outline for our draft racial equity resolution. And as we kind of coalesce the internal and external feedback that we got, we'll start putting the meat on that draft resolution outline, and hope to have it released prior to our April meeting and then have a good public discussion with you and stakeholders about it at our April meeting. So I just wanted to give you an update on that and progress moving forward with respect to that effort.
Thank you. Dr. Hunter?
Yeah, just to clarify, for the external engagement plan that is that will be developed, will the staff, I see that there are two, as described as two associated public meetings to discuss the draft racial equity resolution. Will that, I'm a little bit confused about how the sure. internal engagement plan is touches on or relates to the external engagement plan. And then when we get public input, will it be solely on the external engagement plan, or how are those two tracks going to integrate then into a resolution? I may be getting ahead of this, but maybe there's a simple answer right now to help me kind of understand how the process is moving forward.
Yeah, so the internal engagement and the external engagement are separate, but they will be brought together when our racial equity working group starts crafting the racial equity resolution. And I'll just clarify, a little bit more thoroughly the external engagement plan that staff are getting ready to implement. The approach is to provide broad-based outreach through our LIRIS notice lists and announcements on our website about letting people know if they want to engage with us, who they are. Would you like to participate in kind of focus discussions with our staff to help us kind of frame our draft racial equity resolution? Then the other thing we're going to be doing, the staff's going to be doing, is more focused outreach to some targeted stakeholders, some that we've already worked with, some perhaps that we haven't, that we think would provide significant value to this effort. And then convening kind of working group meetings with those folks to have, a dialogue about, where we should be doing, what are the opportunities, what are the challenges, and use that information along with the internal engagement feedback that we got to really start shaping our resolution. The other significant portion of our external engagement are our two meetings. So April, we're going to be talking about the draft racial equity resolution and getting feedback from all of you as a board, as well as any other members from the public that wish to, you know, provide a comment before you during that April meeting. That will kind of reshape the resolution that we're proposing in draft form in April into a proposed resolution that we'll then be bringing to the board, hopefully in June. So there'll be another opportunity for public engagement there. We'll be releasing that proposed resolution for public comment as well. And whatever discussion that we have during that June meeting about your consideration of the proposed resolution will also inform the effort. Does that answer your question?
Thank you for that. Yeah, thank you for that additional time, the timing on this. So it's envisioned to go for at least two more sessions involving the board. So good to know.
Yeah, and I also just like to point out that, you know, we are ahead of our other regional partners with respect to crafting a draft and proposed racial equity resolution for your consideration. And I just also want to make sure, you know, we're trying to do this as expeditiously as possible, but we want to balance this effort with making sure that we do fully engage to the extent that we can with all willing stakeholders. So, you know, depending on how our external engagement strategy goes and the extent to which we can get really informed input from a diverse group of stakeholders, we may look at extending this a little bit longer, but our hope is to bring this to you in a proposed resolution in June.
And then the last question I have on this, I recall that initially staff was engaged, or we had a representative engaged with State Water Board Working Group.
Yeah.
Is that a continuing process? Is there a timeline associated with that? Do you know?
So Angela Schroeder of our staff was on the statewide racial equity working group. And so she had a hand in, you know, doing some of the outreach related work and coordination on developing the State Water Board's racial equity resolution. She is going to continue to kind of keep tabs on the statewide effort. With respect to that statewide effort, the State Water Board is now focusing on developing their action plan as one of the action items associated with that resolution. And so they're kind of reshifting their focus and putting together kind of a new working group to do that effort and to kind of get input associated with that from all of the regions. They're going to be asking for each of the regions and divisions at the State Water Board to put up staff to help support that action plan effort. In light of where we are at in our process and the significant staff resources that we're applying to this, Angela is going to continue to keep tabs on and provide input to that effort. But she is not going to be able to participate to the extent that she has been up until this point, because she's really focusing her efforts on our internal racial equity effort. And so the primary thing that she'll be trying to do is making sure that, you know, the resolution that we develop and the action items that State Water Board develop can be aligned as much as possible, such that they're not incongruent with each other. And we can line things up appropriately. So she's going to help inform that effort as it relates to our effort moving forward.
Great. Thank you for that, you know, quick summary. I think our involvement and our leadership, you know, in the state, I think is something that I'm very proud of. And I think the staff has really stepped forward and we have a lot to offer, I think, to the state process. So I'm glad that we had that opportunity, but I agree. And that's why I was curious about how much time and effort, you know, we have available for that broader statewide effort and and glad to see that we're narrowing down and focusing in. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And just in closing, I mean, I really appreciate your asking. You know, this is a really high priority for us as a region and statewide. And it cuts across all of our programs, but it comes at a cost. You know, we do not have dedicated resources to do this type of work on top of our core regulatory programmatic activities. And so we're kind of having to free up some staff to create some time and space to do this work because we see it as such a high priority. But we also have to be careful in honoring all the other, you know, water quality focus work that we do. And, you know, hopefully in time, what we will find is that, you know, and we're doing this in other areas too, like with climate change, that, you know, racial equity starts to permeate across our org chart and all of our programs, and it becomes a common part of our culture and how we look at the work that we do.
Yeah, and I really applaud that strategy, and I think it's a very efficient way of integrating a high priority effort without the resources and the dedicated staff. And I think we've seen the success of that with, you know, human right to water, environmental justice, and more generally, and climate change. And it has built, you know, initially it was pretty slim and we had some ideas and some guidance, and then we left it up to staff to start to define for that, for those programs, how that looks and what opportunities they would have to contribute to the, to those priorities. So I really admire the ingenuity, I think, in trying to do a lot and a heavy lift with very little. So congrats to the staff. I'm sure what we see coming forward in April is going to be very, very substantive and very meaningful to our stakeholders as well as to the staff internally. So I'm very anxious to see how it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter. Yeah, I too want to echo, I believe there's 5 or 6 staff members that self-selected to be part of this group. And I know that it's taking time away from their other responsibilities. So very much appreciate them stepping up and taking this on. And similar to Dr. Hunter, you know, there is a heavy lift at the beginning of these, but to the extent that we embed them really in all the work that we do as we have climate change and human right to water, it's again just part and parcel of how we need to relate to water resources and water quality. There isn't one element of water quality that gets opted out because they're in a certain neighborhood or another neighborhood. And you know, it's really important for us to understand that. So I'm really happy to see this external effort happening. To the extent that we can get something passed in June, I would be very excited about that. But we do have a region where there are folks that aren't on our LIRIS list, as I mentioned, you know, in our state board item, and it might take a little bit longer to get folks engaged. We have a, you know, a rural region, we ought to have some, you know, geographic representation throughout our region in order to really onboard some of these issues. So I'm sure you're taking all that into consideration as you look at those external stakeholders. You know, and then just partnering on work that is already being done. I'm going to invoke integrated regional water management again and the needs assessment that was conducted throughout our Central Coast funding area, the tribal communities that were engaged, and underrepresented communities that were engaged, that we could piggyback on, you know, some of that work, certainly, and the communities that were conducted needs assessment and had outcomes there. So that might be another opportunity to synergize resources. I don't have anything else. Any other items on number 16 that Michael might want to talk about?
Okay, so that concludes the two write-up items that we just briefed you on. And as always, executive officer's report includes our standard performance tables as it relates to 401 water quality certifications received and issued, groundwater case closure items, and enrollments and general orders and waivers. And just want to see if you have any comments or questions regarding some of those standard performance tables.
I do not. Do my colleagues? Okay.
No hands. Have I?
No hands. So it's 12:34. Great appreciation to Ms. Hamilton, Dr. Wolf.
I think we had potentially a public comment on this item.
Yeah, and I was just scanning that myself, and I do not
Thank you for reminding me. Yes, Ms. Olson, do we have a public comment on item number 16?
It was Mrs. Bruner, and she is not available now. She's not here.
Yeah,
she did send an email.
Yeah, I see she left the attendees list.
Yes, ma'am.
Great, thank you. Okay, so I don't believe we have any other items on our agenda for today. I wanted to thank Ms. Hamilton, Ms. Tryon, Ms. Yu, Ms. Schroeder, Mr. Packard, Mr. Moskal, Mr. Mertens, all the folks who joined us today to provide good content and move the items forward. And it's 12:35. At this time, I'm happy to adjourn the meeting. Wish everybody a really good weekend.
And I would like to add to this before we close. Thank you, Chair Gray, for a very good job. And you brought these 2 days of meetings very, very smoothly. We all know that we knew we were going to be in good hands, but you certainly demonstrated that for the last 2 days. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the kind words. Hopefully not a lot of air turbulence and it was a safe landing.
We like a little airflow anyways.
Unfortunately, there's no snacks or beverages along with the ride, but at some point in time, we'll be able to regroup personally.
I think.
Yes, yeah. Looking forward to that. And very, very happy that we're on a good path. We have a lot of work to do. We always, as usual, year to year, but this year in particular, we've got some money coming our way. So let's see what we can do.
A quick turnaround on that money, though. We've got to be really acting.
That's why I punched it in at the last minute. It's like, let's get on that money train. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna do the best we can to lead all of our dischargers and stakeholders to the funding trough, the extent to which they drink from it, and they can get, shovel ready proposals submitted. That's a whole nother story. And the extent also to which we can help them, with any of that pre-planning is questionable, but we will certainly be looking at providing, recommendations of support, most certainly. With respect to project applications for meaningful projects in our region to try to help to get them funded.
Well, I think we ought to avail ourselves of the technical assistance that is out there, lots of these folks to coalesce around projects and to get applications in. I mean, there's certainly resources. And so if we're not providing that because we have, 500 other things that are not on our agenda to do that we're already doing, I think it behooves us to provide those resources of the state board and other entities who are funded to do those technical assistance services. And I'm sure we have a list of those folks that can support.
Agreed.
Okay. Happy weekend, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.